My light didn't go on. There you go.
Okay.
Got it. Good morning and welcome to the March 5th meeting of the San Luis Obispo County Board of Supervisors. I ask you to please rise and join us in the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. Before we get started this morning, I'd like to remind everybody to that there are hearing devices available for those that need them. The speaker slips are in the back, and they need to be turned in, and we're asking that they be turned in before we start. So anybody that's got a speaker slip out there, you need to get them turned in. And we are going to continue in the policy and procedure that we set forth last week to be courteous, be brief, and do the work that we need to do here in the county. So if there is a problem and somebody steps out of line, we will call for recess. And if it still continues, we will clear the room. So everybody that wasn't here last week, you're now warned, and we will continue with that. Thank you very much. Okay, Madam Clerk.
Amendment number one to the board agenda. Addendum to item number 9, Program Year 2013 Action Plan. Staff recommends replacement of Exhibit A, Attachment 3, for the Program Year 2013 Action Plan funding recommendations to provide updated information on funding recommendations for the City of Arroyo Grande and correct and invert errors on the exhibit. Added item to closed session, 1, Pending Litigation. A, conference with legal counsel existing litigation, number 7, concerned landowners in the Paso Robles groundwater basin versus County of San Luis Obispo. Requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement.
Thank you. I have one request to speak on the agenda this morning. That's Mr. Greeny.
Mine is public comment. It's not consent.
It says item number 6.
It's public comment.
Okay, I'm sorry. Excuse me. It's been a long week.
Well,
bring it back to the board. Anybody have comments on the agenda, corrections, or any items they'd like to have pulled? We'll start with Mr. Gibson.
I have none, sir.
Okay, Mr. Hill?
None, thank you.
Ms. Arnold?
None.
Mr. Meacham?
I got my questions answered from Mr. Hamm.
That are figuring out how to implement those cuts, so until that happens, we won't have specific detail. But I thought I'd speak generally what this means. For non-defense discretionary spending, it's a 5% annual cut, but since we are partway through the federal fiscal year, that equates for a 9% cut through the balance of the federal fiscal year. Now, that being said, the non-defense discretionary does exclude many entitlement programs, such as the TANF program, which is welfare to work, foster care, child support, Social Security, and some of the other entitlement programs. So those will not be impacted, which means that since those programs make up a lion's share of the federal budget, that a 5% cut to the other discretionary areas could be fairly significant. Defense spending is slated for an 8% cut, which would equate to about 13% for the remainder of the federal fiscal year. You know, bigger picture, what does this look like? The cuts in total are a little over $100 billion a year for 10 years, totaling about $1 trillion. And, you know, one of the big things being discussed is what does this mean for the economy overall with this type of pullback in spending, particularly in the defense area? And the estimates are that it could impact the economy through an impact to gross domestic product to the tune of 0.5% to 1%. Now, the economy has been growing fairly slowly in the 2 to 2.5% range, so a 0.5% to 1% impact could be significant. Now, those are just theories at this point. Nobody knows how that will really play out, so we'll have to see, but those are some of the current economic estimates at this point in time. So we are working with our federal lobbyists, with CSAC, and with the other agencies and legislators to find out what this will mean, and I'll certainly provide an update to your board when I have more information.
Thank you, Mr. Buckshy. Questions from colleagues? Okay, thank you. Mr. Greening, you're on top. You're on the top of the other list. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
We'll all get there sooner or later. Anyway, thank you and good morning. And I want to return to some unfinished business from your consideration of the legislative platform last time. You pulled item number one, but you also discussed what was goal five and is now goal four, CEQA reform. And given that there are now 26 bills introduced in the California legislature that purport one way or another to reform CEQA, I think it's important that we look at our goal and revise it. I have some suggested language to replace the language you have. And when you come back to discuss goal number one, I'd suggest that you put goal number five or four on the table as well. My suggested wording is, quote, closely monitor legislation which purports to reform the California Environmental Quality Act, supporting reforms that eliminate redundant steps without compromising thoroughness, and that protect and enhance the public's right to bring forth relevant information, comma, while opposing moves to exempt politically favored classes of projects from scrutiny and mitigation. And I can provide that language to you as you get closer to a hearing. I might refine it a little more, but I think that's the sort of direction we should be giving. SB 731, which was the one we discussed last week, it's just one of 26, and it actually is more sort of a placeholder for the other legislation or following legislation, because it says it's the intent of the legislature to enact. But it does have language such as that are intended, these are to enact reforms that are intended to provide greater certainty for smart infill development. When I see a word like certainty, it sounds like an end run around environmental information and environmental mitigation. We already have a way to balance the positive impacts of a project against the negative impacts. It's called findings of overriding considerations. It should be undertaken after we have the information base to make the wisest decision possible and mitigate every impact possible. It should not be made at the beginning of the process by just saying this belongs to the class of projects we're going to call smart growth, therefore we're going to deprive this community of any opportunity for mitigation of its impacts so that we can give certainty to the proponents. That's not what the California Environmental Quality Act is all about. So in sum, when you bring back goal one, please also bring back goal five or four for further work. It
thank
needs
you, Mr.
it. Thank
Daniel.
You.
Thank you very much. Okay. Jesse Arnold, followed by Joseph Roulet and Tom Dawson.
Thank you, Chairman Teixeira and members of the board. I'm very happy to be here. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria. 9570. And I'll probably repeat that again. In fact, I will right now. 544-9570. As far as labeling, I think you know 45% of the consumers voted last year that they want labeling. And certainly at a farmer's market, there should be labeling. A lot of us want it. But I think even those who are in favor of genetic engineering would want it, because after all, if they're in favor of it, wouldn't they want to know that the corn they're buying is genetically engineered and that's what they want, and they could buy more and eat more of it? But there is another concern. I think it should be withdrawn until it's proven safe. I've given you a flyer that outlines case that corn sold there is BT corn. It is registered with the EPA as a pesticide because there's a bacterial toxin in there to kill the worms when they munch on the corn. But it's approved by the FDA for human consumption. Well, based on what? Based on tests done by the Monsanto company, and I'm not willing to stake anything on their word as to the safety of their product. And we know full well that the FDA has okayed plenty of drugs, like Vioxx. You've all heard the stories. They okayed the drugs, which later turned out to be harmful or lethal to the people who used them. So I think we should have full safety testing from an independent body before we have it in farmers' markets. And you can call Peter Janke at 544-9570 and let him know what you think. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Arnold. Joseph Roulet, and I hope I pronounced that close enough.
Roulet, it's close enough.
Tom Dawson and Lindy Owen.
Based on public comment, many of those that attend these board meetings have concerns about the integrity of the board and the way it deals with personnel problems. The issue regarding Supervisor Gibson may be resolved in the minds of some members of the board. However, based on public comments, it's not resolved to the satisfaction of the voters. Several months ago, counsel for the board stated she had personally reviewed several thousand emails between Supervisor Gibson and his legislative assistant, and that the majority of them were for official purposes. What is this unspecified majority? 50% plus one? 75%, 99%. Since this same counsel reports to the supervisors, that statement's tantamount to O.J. Simpson's attorney, Johnny Cochran, telling the judge and jury he reviewed the evidence and the majority of it showed that his client was innocent. Let me state here and now, for the record, I am not in any way questioning the honesty, sincerity, or integrity of counsel. On the contrary, I've had dealings with county counsel attorneys in the past and found them to all be honest and sincere. The review that allegedly cleared this entire matter up was not an independent arm's-length review. Consequently, it didn't clear up anything. This should have been turned over to the district attorney's office, state attorney general, or an independent agency to investigate. As it stands now, there are many unanswered questions. Mr. Gibson may be a fine, honest supervisor or a total scoundrel. We voters want information and answers. If we don't get it from an open review, we can trust. We will reach our own conclusions, certainly in time for the next election. Remember, our perceptions are our reality. As I understand it now, Mr. Gibson's paramour is, again, or will soon be working directly under his supervision as his legislative assistant, and as such, he is responsible for writing her evaluations. This should not be. Do other employees in the supervisor's office feel their evaluations are always going to suffer because of this unhealthy relationship? How can they feel otherwise? I worked in federal law enforcement for 27 years, the last 16 in management, including 3 years in Washington, D.C. This relationship that exists here does not exist openly in any agency or business I have ever come in contact with. How many military officers have lost their command over similar activities? I am not suggesting the termination of Supervisor Gibson's legal assistant. As a valuable employee, she could easily be assigned to another supervisor as legislative assistant, and that supervisor's assistant be assigned to work for Mr. Gibson. Supervisor, something needs to be done and done now. Thank you.
Thank you. Tom Dawson, followed by Lindy Owen and Ben DeFada.
Tom Dawson. Mr. Chairman, at the last meeting, a supervisor launched into a monologue on the Republic and how a simple majority should be the rule for all ballot measures and elections. The supervisor just could not understand why a two-thirds vote was needed for tax increases. So I thought I would enlighten the supervisor on how the rest of the Republic works. The people of the state of California have fought for many years to protect their property and income from avaricious political schemers. These politicians became so ingrown and greedy that they actually caused people to lose their homes in the 1970s. As a result, we the people have made it very difficult for never satisfied, quote, public servants, unquote, to get their hands on our money. There he should uphold and follow the Constitution. He should serve everyone in his region, not just his cronies, and then he can pursue his ideological agenda for as long as it is constitutional. The minority has rights and by law cannot be abused by the majority. Only the corrupt try to go beyond these constraints. Please keep taxes down since we are trying to recover from this major recession. When taxes stay down, revenues increase. The county government is here to serve the people, not the people to serve the county, or to provide unlimited funds for the county. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dawson. Lindy Owen, followed by Ben DeFada, Elsa Dawson, and Julie Tacker.
Good morning. Lindy Owen from lovely Los Osos, where it's lucky to be able to see through the dirt and dust. Last week, Supervisor Gibson proposed that we put some limitations on public comment because it was repetitious, and that what was the other point that he made? That we were taking up too much time of the Board of Supervisors meetings with public comment, and that just leaves us that back in 2009 he did the same thing when he didn't want to hear the sewer issues that were coming forward, and the room was packed. There were people that were very upset at the decisions being made and the direction that this board took our choice of wastewater treatment and water basin problems. And so, yes, we had limitations put on our speech. People from Los Osos could only speak for a total of 10 minutes, 2 minutes apiece. So that meant five people could speak from Los Osos, and in the afternoon another group could come back in and five would be allowed to speak. So we're going through the same kind of thing, and I think Mr. Gibson's not happy with the discussion about his affair with his legislative assistant. I want to ask Mr. Supervisor Teixeira, where is the policy that was going to be established for legislative assistance? Each of you gets one. They get $70,000 almost of our tax money. It's not that they're privately funded by each of you. We, the taxpayers, fund them. And there appears to be no policy. I had questions like, what do they do? What are they supposed to do? What are their responsibilities? Are they on a time clock? Do they have a 40-hour week? Is there a schedule? When they travel, do they travel with a supervisor? Do they walk the supervisor's dogs? I have those questions. And I would hope that, Mr. Teixeira, we could get that policy moving. It's now been, I think, 2 months since you said that you were going to get one put together. And so maybe County Council can address whether they've had time to do it or if they're still going through emails. And those emails are not being released to the public, which I think is shameful, too. I think it's timely that they come out. Then I just wanted to talk about the Los Osos community is still in the dark. We've had no information, no updates. Mr. Gibson said he'd start bringing updates. Not one single update in 4.5 months. No newspaper articles, no farmers market booths. We're paying $7.6 million for this contract, which was very easy for you to approve, but now who's doing the follow-up? Where's the oversight? We're not getting anything. Variety of activities such as media relations, neighborhood coffee socials, tabling at special events, farmers market, Oktoberfest, triathlon, nothing. I hope you can get some oversight on this. Thank you.
Mr. DeFatto, followed by Elsa Dawson and Julie Tacker.
Good morning, Board, Sheriff, and public. I am Ben DeFatto from Los Osos. Chairman, we all heard you and Supervisor Gibson for about 10, 15 minutes last week about setting time limits on public comments. Well, all the time, he does all the talking. That happens to be Mr. Gibson's MO whenever he is in trouble, some kind of trouble, or is trying to hide something. At this time, Chairman Teixeira, it sounded like he was looking to you to be the fall guy or the bad guy for this suggestion to curtail public comments. Mr. Gibson is in deep Bandini right now and is feeling the heat throughout this county. It is an embarrassment and violation of the county's human resources policy that was made for everybody, not just for the peons. Just like astronaut Jim Lovell said halfway to the moon, Houston, we have a problem. Well, this county's board of supervisors has many problems it won't address. The public understands affairs happen, and they really don't care what he does with his personal life, but her $69,000 salary is paid for with money from the taxpayers of this county, not Mr. Gibson's money. So in reality, the public does have a say on how the board's policy should be. But to take it out on the rest of the public, that's because a man who has, we have on here, a couple of pages, at least, days of tight money, the public is mad at politicians wasting their tax money. For many years, the public has told this county to do something about getting rid of nuclear waste, get rid of the Wallace Group's conflict of interest, doing an outside investigation of Capslos Trust Fund, a place for those homeless and campers and trailers, see that the homeless don't get ripped off, Oceano's flooding problems, the building of an affordable sewer project for Los Osos, Call it a lack of trust. The people are tired of politicians who spend and spend and spend and don't care about this country and people. These
Thank
people
you,
are pink old commies.
Elsa Dawson, followed by Julie Tacker and Bill Pelfrey.
Good morning, Elsa Dawson, San Luis Obispo. I want to thank you supervisors last week who invited us to communicate with you privately in your offices, on your phone, on your email. We really appreciate that. I especially like the idea of a town hall meeting. That sounds very exciting and informative. but I got a little confused at one point because Mr. Gibson began sort of demeaning Supervisor Arnold about her reluctance on lowering the voting threshold, saying several times that she should take it to the voters, that you can trust the voters. You should listen. You can't go wrong listening to the voters. I believe that that's what he said. But earlier in the morning, he was ready to drastically reduce her ability to listen to the voters by cutting our speech time. You know, I am in favor of an expectation of decency, and I expect that from both sides of the bench. So I agree with that. But when the conversation turns to limiting our speech, I begin to feel that you don't care about us. And that is confusing because isn't there a strong emphasis on compassion in the campaign platform? Or is that just selective compassion? Along those lines, Supervisor Gibson's idea of deferring payment for the higher property tax for the elderly so they can stay in their homes, you know, that sounds so compassionate, but it turns out to just be a bureaucratic trick. Imagine the surprise of the grieving heirs once Grandma and Grandpa are gone when they find out that they're being smacked with this huge accumulative tax bill. It's stealing the next generation's inheritance. They'll be robbed of the resources that they would need to establish a business, thus promoting a strong economy. You know, I believe heirs are vital to our stable society. We mustn't disable them by passing on a huge debt. Yes, listen to the voters. We won't vote for lowering that threshold. Now back to compassion. Tell me, can you be for big government? Can you be in favor of raising taxes? Can you be for bureaucratic, big bureaucracy and still be for the little guy? Common sense tells me no. And we little people, we want a government that serves us, protects us, not one that enslaves us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Julie Tacker, followed by Bill Pelfrey, excuse me, and Richard Margeson.
Good morning. I'm just Julie Tacker from District 2, and at the risk of being marginalized as repetitive, I will continue to call for the investigations into the Gibson Espiro and the Capslow matters and the resignation of Supervisor Gibson. I did mention last week that I have an outstanding Public Records Act request with County Council. Yesterday, I called renowned expert Terry Frank of Calaware and explained that County Council had looked at 6 years of the supervisor's emails with his legislative assistant and the travel reimbursements and invoices between the two, and over the course of just 3 days, County Council exonerated the supervisor and his legislative assistant from using any county resources. But yet when I wanted to see the record that Ms. Neal reviewed, I'm 3 months out from being able to see that record. And Mr. Frank agreed with me that if it's taken this long, my suspicion is probably right in that county resources were used in the affair. what human relations policies. I just want to see that you live by your words. Mr. Teixeira is quoted in the paper that this was something that they were going to look at, and we are 3 months out from the announcement of the affair between Mr. Gibson and Mrs. Spiro, and I don't see any resolution. And until there's an independent investigation, I don't believe we will.
Thank you, Ms. Tucker. Bill Pelfrey, followed by Richard Margeson.
My name is Bill Pelfrey. I'm from Districts 1 and 2 because of a decision this board made. I'm represented by Mr. Meacham and Debbie Arnold. I'm reminded of the duties of an elected official because I am on that advisory group and I am up for election. When I do that, I reread the Constitution. Am I up for another round of listening to all the people that call me, that ask me if I'm going to the Board of Supervisors, could I meet this? Or if I'm in TAG, is there something I can do to help them? When you run for an office, even if it's as minor as mine, or the next step up is yours, it is your right to serve the people. It's public servant. You're not meant to rule. You're meant to listen to the people. You are elected to hear their complaints and hopefully do something about it. Your job precisely is to listen and evaluate what the people have to say, to negotiate with the people desires so that they may feel secure in their homes and property, and allow them to live up to their potential of the Constitution and their freedoms of choice, the rights guaranteed them therein. It is not to say that you don't need to listen to the people because it interferes with your business, and you're right, this is not a town hall meeting. It is a business meeting, but your business is the people's business. It is not for the environmental elitists to tell you what the people's business is. The previous board went off on certain things. You wonder why people come here? This is just a partial list. You tried to take the freedom of assembly and freedom of speech in a consent agenda because of the Occupy America protests. You want an infill ordinance. And then most of the last 6 months, you neglected the quality of life with these environmental elitists. Taking of property like the added cluster, densifying our communities with the smart growth and sustainable communities, attempting to take over water rights, making a mandatory invasion of homes when you did the energy-wise, something the police are not even allowed to do. If you do a remodel on your home, you now are subject to somebody coming in. That's just not right. If you want the people to quit doing here, do what's right by the people, not right by your personal agendas. The environmental elitists may not be right. We can't even forecast the weather, but you say you know what's coming down in 20 and 25 years, and the people living today must make a change for the people tomorrow. You can't do it. It just doesn't exist in the scientific world. You can make your best guess. Why are we paying for something that may or may not happen? Your responsibility is our quality of life. What we bring to you, because we do not understand, we need your help.
Thank you, Mr. Pelfrey. Mr. Margeson, and I will remind you that you need to get your slips in on time.
Okay. I'm not going to waste time talking about that. Richard Margeson, I know people were offended by what Mr. Salmon said a couple of weeks ago, and the Tribune has taken issue with that. But then the Tribune turns around on Friday in their brickbat and bouquet section, and in a segment dealing with public comment here at the Board of Supes, talking about the direction it's gone over the last few weeks, there's a line in there that says, "How bad is it? Well, we thought listening to those crazy anti-sewer manifestos every Tuesday was bad." I'm just as offended. I'd like the Tribune to produce any evidence that I'm crazy. I've never been institutionalized. I've never seen a psychologist. I don't leave here and go back to a padded cell. I may be passionate, but I'm not crazy. And I don't think anybody that got $2 million. When you're out in that area, drive down San Isabel and look and see if you think that's worth $1.2 million, that half mile, the $1.2 million half mile in Los Osos. You know what else is crazy? Is the CSD asked the county to come and take advantage of their meetings, which are replayed twice a day, to give updates on the sewer. Staff refused to come. That's what Tribune should be investigating. 60 meetings a month could be replayed.
Ms. Warren, I will acknowledge your request to speak, but like I said earlier, from now on, we're not going to take late requests. So come forward at this time, please.
Susan Warren from Cambria. And I wanted to speak to civil discourse and what some of the other folks have been speaking to. And that's with the public bringing concerns forward. And I was here 30 years ago in front of the Board of Supervisors because I had issues in our community in Cambria in trying to get some resources there. We still have the same issues. And in particular, those issues happen to be around substance abuse, detox, counseling, any kind of treatment. All we were asking for was one therapist. What we did get was the Cambria Connection, which was a pilot, and there were four more centers set up throughout the county. We have just Cambria Connection and North County Connection left. Mike, what I have watched over the years is that people don't feel heard when they come up here because they haven't been acknowledged through some type of action. We got a little bit of action then, but since then what I've seen is a systematic piece by that department, which happened to be drug and alcohol at the time, to try to not provide service or to provide mediocre service. I worked in that department from 1990 to 2000, and there was complaints not only from the community about all the same issues throughout the county, but also internally with the staff going, why are we doing mediocre programs? Why are you disabling and taking away anything that the work that was working and the public wants to have spread throughout the county. Well, what it didn't make sense. They hired a PR person to the community to divert them, and the staff found out we were all in the same union, so nothing could be done, and that became a stalemate. And your option was to leave if you didn't like the way things were being done. I think. And prove me wrong, I think the root problem in this county is your pension plan because it has to be fed by county employees. It's a standalone pension plan. It is not part of a bigger pool like CalPERS or any of those. So you have to keep a lot of employees going in that are 5 years and under, which is perfect for Human Services Department because you can hire interns out of Cal Poly. They're only there to get their hours, and then they're going to leave. They feed into that pension plan, and then they're gone. But you've got to have a lot of people to cover the retirees and everybody else because this pension plan only answers to itself, and it has to feed itself. And I think that is something you need to look at because I feel that's a big issue.
Okay, that concludes my request to speak. Ms. Neal.
Yes, good afternoon, or good morning, Chairman Teixeira, Rita Neal, your county council. I would like an opportunity to explain to the board the public records request that has been mentioned on a number of occasions by Ms. Tacker. That public records request was for all emails between Supervisor Gibson and Mrs. Sparrow between the years 2007 to 2012. I'd already provided this board with my conclusions as to my review of the circumstances surrounding that relationship, but let me focus for a minute on that request. Initially, we requested that she narrow that request, and she did not want to do that, which is certainly her right. So in order to provide public records, we want to be transparent, but there's also, within the Public Records Act and case law, numerous exemptions. So I was able to review those emails fairly quickly by scrolling through the emails after those computers were imaged. In order to make them available to the public, those emails have to be reviewed and redacted for any information that is exempt from disclosure. I had my office staff going through all of those emails, including all the redundant emails, because once they're in PDF, it's more difficult to take out the redundant ones, and we have to go through and redact all attorney-client information, personal information from constituents, personal phone numbers, and any other information that might be exempt under the Public Records Act or case law. I have a staff person who's been taking been working from home on her computer on the evenings and weekends. Thus far, we've turned over 1,500 to 2,000 pages to both the Tribune and to Ms. Tacker. Those were for the years 2007 and 2012. The Tribune had made the same request, but they had agreed to narrow their request to only the years 2007-2012. We are getting ready at this point to turn over another probably 2,500 pages, but we're still in the redaction process. And let me also explain, my staff person goes through and does the redaction, and then we have to have an attorney go through and complete the redaction to make sure that we've caught everything that is exempt, that there's especially attorney-client privilege information. So we're in that process now, and I'm hoping to be able to turn over another 2,500 pages after those emails are turned over in PDF format. And again, many, many of these emails are redundant, and so each redundant email has to be redacted again. We probably have 8 to 10 more thousand pages to review and redact. So we're working as diligently as we can. At one point in time, my office had a half-time attorney several years ago, and almost all she did was work on public records requests. Our budget doesn't allow that anymore, so we are trying to prioritize our work to do the work that's necessary for the county to be transparent, to respond to Public Records Act requests. And I also just want to make it clear, this is not the only Public Records Act request that my office is working on currently. We work on them on a regular basis with other departments. So we're doing the best we can to prioritize and get the information out to the public as it's requested. And I'm happy to answer any questions about that for you.
Thank you, Ms. Neal. Questions?
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Gibson?
Ms. Neal, do you have a count of roughly how much staff time or staff cost has been portrayed to them?
At this point in time, we're keeping track of the hours, and one thing we have been doing with Public Records Act requests, we're trying to track our hours in total for all requests. Mm-hmm. I would say on this particular request thus far, we've spent anywhere from 80 to 100 hours of just staff time. That doesn't include attorney time. And again, it's not as much the reviewing the emails as it is the redaction and going through this to make them available to the public.
And just in terms of this board, you know, in our budgeting and your resources, do you have a sense of how much more staff time is being applied to other Public Records Act requests that you have?
Well, certainly this is taking the most staff time at this point. But again, some public records requests are fairly simple to respond to, and a lot of the departments are very good at responding to us, getting us information that we need, and we can review them quickly. Others ask for thousands of documents. We have another public records request right now that we're working with the planning department on, and again, that's thousands and thousands of documents that have to be reviewed and redacted. So I'm hoping to come back to this board at some point in time to give you an overview of what we estimate the time is that we spend on reviewing a public records request, responding to those, and trying to put a cost to it as well.
I'd appreciate that. I, you know, we've dealt with this issue for for you know, all the time I've been in office, certainly large projects like the Los Osos sewer, you know, have prompted huge Public Records Act requests. I think it would be useful for both the board and the public to know, you know, what our requirements are for responding to these requests, and your office does a remarkable job in being as timely as you can, and to have that information available as we go forward to consider our...
Yeah, and I just want to make it clear, you know, certainly the Public Records Act is meant to bring transparency, and so it isn't as though we mind responding to Public Records Act requests, but I think it's just an understanding of the public of what it takes to actually respond to that. There is no limit on... the information that people can ask for, but we have to make a legal determination of what is disclosable and what isn't. So,
thank you, Ms. Neal. Further comments from colleagues? Okay, then we'll go on to the next item, Madam.
Mr. Chairman, yes, ma'am. I wondered, we did have a request, and maybe Mr. Buckshy, the questions about our legislative assistants, how we hire them. There were some questions. Each office has one. Do you mind responding to somewhat to the questions? And
Dan Buckshy, County Administrator. As the current policy sits, each district is allocated one legislative assistant. That position is an at-will.
Any further comments from colleagues? Madam Clerk, would you introduce the next item, please?
Item number 7, submittal of the fiscal year 2012-2013 second quarter financial report.
Good morning, Ms. Jackson.
Good morning. I am Emily Jackson from the County Administrative Office, here to provide your board with an overview of the second quarter financial report, which covers county operations for the period of October 1st through December 31st, 2012. So overall, departments report that they're on track and are operating within budget as of the end of the second quarter. Countywide expenditures and revenues as of the end of the second quarter are fairly consistent with the same period last year. And as noted in the report, I just want to point out that revenue realization rates appear to be below what you might expect for halfway through the year, but that's really due to the fact that some of the county's largest revenue sources, property taxes, for example, are typically realized closer to the end of the fiscal year. Similar to prior quarterly reports, only departments reporting issues as of the end of the second quarter reported on in this report. So this second quarter report highlights a few departments that are reporting financial or operational issues, and I'll run through those briefly now. First is the refund of the property tax administrative fee, which there's been some discussion about prior. By statute, California counties are responsible for the administration of local property taxes, and to fund this, counties charge a fee to the entities that they collect taxes on behalf of. Recently, there has been some legal action between cities and counties over the collection of this fee, and based on a previous Superior Court ruling, the County of San Luis Obispo has been charging an appropriate fee along with other counties throughout the state. However, the City of Alhambra and some other cities down in the Los Angeles County area recently filed suit against the County of Los Angeles over a portion of the fees that are charged, and the appellate court and later Superior Court actually overturned previous court rulings stating that counties could not continue to include property tax revenue that is received in lieu of vehicle license fee and sales and use tax in their calculations to determine how property tax administrative fees are charged. As a result of that Supreme Court ruling, all 58 counties in California must refund a portion of the property tax administrative fees that they have been charging to cities. Locally, that means that the County of San Luis Obispo will need to be refunding $1.9 million to cities within the incorporated cities within the county by the end of the current year. Ongoing, there's an impact of this. If we don't continue charging this fee, which we won't, it's going to pose a $500,000 impact to our budget moving forward. But this has been accounted for, and this loss of revenue will be built into the fiscal year 13-14 budget as well as subsequent budgets. Next, I want to talk a little bit about the agreement with the courts to defer mainframe costs. Due to state budget challenges, the county struck a deal with a superior court to defer for 2 years the mainframe costs that the court pays for hosting their criminal justice information system on the county's mainframe. The county struck this deal due to the fact that the court would not have been able to continue operating the system, which provides very valuable information to county departments, and instead would have had to revert back to a paper-based system, which would have posed a significant public safety risk to the community. In light of that, the county agreed to defer mainframe costs for 2 years to ensure that the court could continue to operate that system. The amount of deferred revenue will be $440,000 in the current year and in the next year. And in the current year, it's not expected that this deferral will pose any significant service level impacts due to the fact that savings among several different departments will be able to allow the county to absorb the decrease in revenue that we will be receiving. Those departments that will be absorbing some of the costs include information technology, the sheriff, the district attorney, and probation departments, which are the biggest users of that system. Moving forward, the deferral is being taken into consideration as we look to prepare the county's fiscal year 2013-14 budget. And in out years, this situation will somewhat resolve itself in that the court is looking to create an entirely new system which will enable them to get off the county's mainframe and still provide a high level of service to county departments. Next, I want to talk about some more targeted issues under the basic foster care program, and that's due to the fact that the income guidelines for that program were established back in 1996 and have not been revised, and as a result, less and less families and children are qualifying due to their income. The unfortunate impact of that is that the county is picking up additional foster care costs that we have to pay. Next, the implementation of extended foster care went into effect just recently and was not budgeted for in the current year. What extended foster care does is extends foster care benefits for youth from age 18 to 21. And as I said, at the time that we were doing budget prep for the current year, the impacts of that weren't really known, and so the department didn't budget for it. At this point, it appears that the expenditures for extended foster care will be about $250,000, so that is contributing significantly towards the overages that the department is seeing, and it is something that is being incorporated into the department's 13-14 budget, so hopefully we won't see this issue in the coming year. And then finally, the foster care rates that are paid to foster care families continue to increase annually due to recent lawsuits which guarantee those increases. And so that's something that the department isn't always able to plan for. So essentially, the overages are really due to legislative action and court rulings, which the department unfortunately has very little control over. At this time, it's projected that the foster care adoptions budget will end the year about $669,000 over budget. But I want to be clear that only $500,000 of that is county cost. Fortunately, this is not going to require the use of any general fund contingencies. The department is seeing healthy realignment revenue receipts, and we are simply going to need to do an adjustment in the third quarter to bring in additional revenues to cover these increased county costs. So there is no impact to the general fund. And then finally, there we go. Finally, I want to provide a quick update on the status of the airport's finances, which we include in every quarterly report. As of this end of the second quarter, it's expected that airport expenditures will exceed revenues, and as a result, the airport will be using approximately $240 of its cash balance to get through the year, and this is actually slightly less than had initially been anticipated, so that's a good thing. Airport revenues are largely driven by employments, and employments are down 4% compared to the prior time last year. And despite all of that, the good news, however, is that parking fee revenue has actually gone up due to the installation of parking kiosks, which has allowed the airports to recover additional parking revenue that they've not previously been able to recover. So that concludes my report. Today, your board is asked to receive and file the report, approve a budget adjustment in the amount of $550,000 from general fund contingencies for the public defender budget, and approve other miscellaneous requests from departments as are outlined in the staff report and the quarterly report itself. So with that, I'm happy to entertain any questions that the board may have, and we've also got quite a few department heads here for that same purpose.
Questions from colleagues. We'll start with Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Emily, and as you said, I see some of our folks that this is on the airport, so either Ms. Pell or any of the airport management. $240,000 less is coming from which fund for the airport? I see Mr. Howell. Rising, so.
Good morning. Richard Howell, General Manager for Airport Services. That will essentially come out of our cash account, the Airport Revenue Cash Fund, and we have enough money to cover that for this year and probably for another year and moving on, depending how things proceed with revenues in the future.
And Mr. Howell, I have a year two with the kiosks and the recovery. I know that when originally we had talked about the plan and approved going ahead with it, we hoped that ultimately we would see an increase of in terms of recovery of about maybe 15%. Do we have a sense? And I know that, you know, if employments are down and less people are parking, that's going to impact it too. But do we have a sense of what percentage of revenue we are recovering?
Right now, looking at our numbers through the end of the second quarter, we're seeing about a 12% increase in the parking lot revenues. We do have an expenditure that came associated with that we weren't planning on, which was the credit card fees, and there are a variety of reasons for that. But the biggest reason is Visa will not let us pass on a card fee to a user. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to use their card. So that's actually represented some additional expense to us that we hadn't planned on it. But at the margin, we're seeing about 9% at the end of the second quarter that we've with an actual increase. And looking to the future, we can decide how we want to handle those other fees.
Okay.
How to meet the operational costs at some point in time, given the revenue projection. So I won't steal Richard's thunder for the next item. He'll cover that in more detail, but I just did want to add that perspective as well.
Further questions for Mr.
Howell? Indeed, and just following up with Mr. Buckshaw, I mean, what will change in the future that gets this operating deficit in balance? Is it simply a matter of emplanements, or is it some other look at the revenue or expenditure side? I mean, it just wasn't clear to me immediately what can we do about it?
The short answer to that is yes. Yeah. One of the things that we need to do is continuing to take a hard look at our fees. We've got a number of long-term agreements that are coming up. They'll be up for renegotiation. We've maintained status quo a lot of the time since 2008 with the economy the way it's been, but it's really, you know, the airport's kind of sucked it up on a couple of years this year and looking into next year based on what we've done. And we really need to start looking at how do we start recovering all our costs to keep that airport functioning, to keep it safe. On the other side of it, yes, employments will continue to be a big thing. And we have a vibrant air service development group working, you know, with our consultant in the airport. We're looking to reach out to the community later on in this year. And probably in the short term, the fastest way to bring in extra revenue would be, of course, to increase our capacity of seats so that we could increase our employments. Right. An in-plane passenger still represents about $13 to us, so the more passengers we can bring back into the market, the better off.
That's the overall revenue. I mean, that was the other question I had, is you referenced parking as your largest single, and is that even with passenger facility fees as well?
Correct.
And so that's larger than the passenger.
It is. Parking is, by and large, our largest revenue factor.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Beecham.
Well, I don't want to beat this horse to death. what, Richard, what do you see in terms of the trending as far as the employments? And we've been seeing a decline in this. What do you project?
It's been a struggle in California. We have a number of items that are actually to our benefit. We are geographically separated from Los Angeles and San Francisco. That's where our passengers usually travel to. They're not going to Santa Barbara. They're not going to Monterey. They're going all the way. But it was, you know, members of the board and members of the community can remember back in 2007, we had almost 190,000 in-plane passengers that year because we had the seats in the market to do it. So the customers are there. They want to be able to fly out of here. It becomes the right now with the competition in Los Angeles and San Francisco of finding that sweet spot for the carrier where they can get a good fare to operate the piece of equipment in the market they want to operate to the destination they want to go to. Having said that, I think there's some positive things for us. There are some carriers in California that are looking at intrastate. You know, we have people that are interested in Sacramento, and the Pacific Northwest is still a big deal for us to look at. So I think there are still options available to us out there. We've got a good air service marketing plan. It just pushing forward, talking with the carriers, and finding that package that will get them into the market.
Right. Okay. But I guess what I'm trying to establish, and I guess we'll get into this discussion in the next item, but if we're trending in a way that is going to be more of a negative and we have an ongoing deficit here, we're going to have to make some hard choices to figure out when is that tipping point by which we have to do whatever. Whatever is. But at any rate, we can talk about that at a later time. But
okay. Thank you, sir.
It's a concern, though.
Further questions for Mr. Howell? Ms. Neal, you had your light on. You're good? Okay. Mr. Buckshy?
No, not a...
Okay. Got it. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Howell.
Thank you.
I did have one other question, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
When you're amenable. To Ms. Jackson, number 7 on your recommended action list is some movement of funds within Fund Center 230, and I have to confess inability to track down exactly which maintenance project we're talking about and what that movement of funds accomplishes for us. That's a budget adjustment for $330,000 from designated fund balance, yeah. Fund Center 230.
Mr. Chairman, Vince Marici with the County Administrative Office. When the fiscal year 12-13 budget was prepared, the capital projects budget, which is Fund Center 230, has a project to replace, I believe it's a sewer line at the County Ops Center. And there in prior years, there was a project in maintenance to replace a sewer line and a water line. And so we're using the savings from that project and moving it into, we're moving it from maintenance budget into the capital project.
Thanks.
Budget.
That's what I need to know.
Okay. Further comments from colleagues? Okay, I'll open it to the public for public comment. I have no request to speak, so therefore I'll close it to public comment and bring it back to the board.
I'll move staff's recommendation.
Okay.
Second.
And under quick discussion, thanks for those who have contributed funds to the county operation. I think that's worthy of mention every quarter when we do this.
I so agree. Thank you. Madam Chair, roll call vote.
They're going to pick up the slack. I wanted to give you a brief overview today of the project history, the on-site development challenges we've had based on what was happening in the past and what we'll look to see happening in the future. Talk to you a little bit about the design process we used and how we ended up to be where we are today with concepts. Of course, show you a conceptual floor plan and also an architectural concept. Have a brief discussion on what to do with the existing terminal facility as well as the airport offices that are currently in the modulars. We've also produced an initial budget estimate based on these concepts that I have for you today. And then finally, I would hope you have I'd have a recommendation for the board. Oop, wrong way. Just as a brief history, you may remember on March 6th of 2012, your board approved essentially a three-phase terminal design development project. Phase one was the terminal area plan. Phase two was building schematic, and final phase three was final design development. We started a little bit late. It was summer of 2012 before we finally got rolling. Is that better? Thank you. Sorry. It was summer of 2012 before we finally got rolling. And the funding for this is coming from a Federal Aviation Administration grant as well as passenger facility charges that we've collected. Looking at the development history, we had a couple of challenges coming into the project. This slide shows you work that was done prior to you approving the work that we're doing now. The centerpiece is the project we're working on, then the bottom piece is should you elect to move forward, these would be the steps we would be taking. So as you all remember, in 2007, there was a terminal development project. I think it was something on the score of 77,000 square feet. And there was a great deal of infrastructure that had been put into place by my predecessor to meet that goal. Terminal curb front was completed in 2008, and I'll show you an image of this in a minute. The access roadway with resignalization of Highway 227 was completed in 2009. And then we actually completed the aircraft parking apron construction piece in 2010. Your board approved this project again on March 6th of last year. Phase one was the terminal area plan that I'm talking about today. And then we have phase two, schematic, and then phase three, the final design development. This is a standalone project. If we decide not to do anything from that point on, then that's where we are. If the board elects to move forward, then subsequent tasks would be construction documents, bidding and permitting, and then, of course, construction of the facility itself. We currently have funding in place with the grant dollars and PFCs to get the project through construction documents. So talking a little bit about the design process and floor development, floor plan development, as I said, we had to use infrastructure established by our larger facility back in 07. I'll show you how we met that challenge moving forward. The concept development that we had based on meetings in this room where we wanted something that would meet the community's needs for about 5 to 10 years. We wanted something that we could grow into as we needed to grow into it. We didn't want to build it all in one shot. The process we went through for concept selection is Mr. Iskra and a couple of his colleagues came into the community, took tours around San Luis Obispo to get an idea of what goes on in the community, what kind of community character we had. We did some community outreach. We had a concept committee that met that involved business people, members of the county, members of the airport to come up with, you know, what kind of architectural concept did we want to use. We settled on a viticulture theme that emphasized our agriculture and wine production. We met with our terminal tenants, showed them what we were proposing, where we thought we were going, tried to get some initial input from them, again, on the concept of where we were going. Those meetings all went very well and were very well received. So taking a look at the situation we ended up with, As you see here, 2008, the curb front, 2009, the roadway with the signalization of Highway 227, the 2010 apron. This footprint was designed for the 77,000 square foot terminal building. We're not building anywhere near that amount in this project, and so it really became a challenge, especially for Mr. Istra sitting in the audience, on how we were going to make this work. And so we finally settled on we didn't want to do any infrastructure development. If we were to put the terminal where it wanted to be, then we would need to build additional parking apron. If we put the hold room where it wanted to be, we would end up building and moving the curbside. So what we did was we dropped it in the middle, and I'll have a bigger picture of what we're proposing as I move forward. We dropped it in the middle, and we included an open space. So essentially the main terminal building sits up, snuggled up next to the curbside, and the hold room is down there with the airplanes where it wants to be, and we essentially put an open-air courtyard in between the two buildings, or proposing an open-air courtyard. When you look at it up close, pretty standard, not too much different about this terminal that you would see on any other terminal, essentially a 46,500 square feet of main terminal space and hold room. The standard configuration, bag claim, ticketing in the main building, screening, security screening, and then out on the apron, six gates, two at jet bridges, hold room, and then as you see there in the middle, an open-air courtyard, size undetermined. This does a number of things for us, especially when we look ahead in the future to expansion. We've provided for creation of extra lobby or airline operation space to the west side of the building. On the east side, we have room for additional baggage carousels should we need an additional baggage carousel moving into the future. But generally what you're going to find, especially in a market like ours, is you're either going to run out of security checkpoint space because you've got more passengers, or you're going to run out of hold room because you're getting more frequency and, again, more passengers. And what this does is it actually creates a situation where we know exactly where that expansion is going to be. We can take steps to make that expansion happen. If we need additional screening space, well, it'll just grow towards the hold room where it wants to go. If we need more hold room space, then it'll just grow back to the screening checkpoint area where it wants to go. And in doing this, we, A, create the spot where we want to grow to, and, B, we can also plan ahead for a growth that would more money by not having to create additional aircraft parking space to fill in the hole, as you saw in the U in the previous slide. And we also don't have to move the curbside this way.
talking about the existing terminal and the airport offices, we've taken a rough look at what it would take to renovate the existing terminal building. It's an old building. It's got heavy concrete walls throughout most of the facility. The systems are quite old. And so a rough estimate on our part right now is about $2.5 million to renovate that building for use in the future. Of course, there's always potentiality that we could put an RFP out, have it developed by a third party. That's a very strong potential that we would also consider in the future. If we decided we just didn't need it anymore, even though it is old, we don't see any systems in there or hazardous materials, so we think it would be relatively inexpensive, about $500,000 if the building were to be demolished. Talking about the airport offices, and I know some of you have been in our outstanding airport offices, the modulars we've been living in, I think, since 2000 or 2001. We have been looking to see what we could do about moving our airport offices. We did make the conscious decision not to put airport offices on the terminal building because it would be very expensive to design and build. We could move into the existing terminal. Then we're back to that $2.5 million worth of renovation again. With some of you, I've discussed the potentiality that we might move into the three-story complex that was attached to the Site L hangar. Most of you probably remember that as the old American Eagle maintenance facility. It does need a great deal of work. Airline people aren't really known for taking care of their stuff, so that stuff, and it's been there for a very long time. So probably about $400,000 would be needed to bring that in a place where we'd want to be able to occupy it. And we'll flesh out these options and the things we're going to do as we move forward in the project. Initial budget comes bad news, good news. Right now, the approximate cost we're using, again, based on the concepts we develop, is about $22 million. We believe conservatively that $15 million is FAA grant eligible, and we would get $15 million from the FAA. I want to emphasize that is conservative. I do believe there might be some more money there for us. It just depends on how we design it, how we designate the areas, but we wanted to be very conservative in this first estimate. So that would leave a local share of about $7 million. That would include our passenger facility charges and whatever funding source we were to use on top of that. We anticipate having about $3.6 million in PFCs come time for construction. So that'd be about $3.5 million that the airport would have to be looking to do debt service on moving into the future. Again, we will flesh this out as we move forward in the following phases of the project also. So this pretty much concludes my presentation. We're hoping your board would approve the results of Phase 1 of the terminal design development at the airport and authorize us to move into Phase 2. And I'd be more than happy to take any questions.
Questions from colleagues? Ms. Arnold?
I have a comment, maybe more than a question. One quick question, Mr. Howland. That the $22 million?
Yes.
Does that include the $2.5 million terminal renovation? Or
no.
Is that?
No, that was just for construction of the new facility.
Okay. Anyway, the comment that I had, and Mr. Howell was kind enough to take myself and my legislative assistant, Christine Robertson, out to the airport, and we took a tour of all this and got to look at some of these slides before today. I've never seen anything as complicated as what you're dealing with, and just to share with the public, when you start to wrap your head around what they're trying, the predictions and the projections that they're trying to make as we go forward with this expansion, it's just so complicated, and I was just amazed, and so wanted to share quickly. I first want to compliment Mr. Howell for the practical thinking and having adjusted this project for today's needs with keeping in mind what the future might hold. Very hard thing to predict in today's economic times, but they're grappling with serving customer needs, and I know for myself and all of us, even my past job working for the state senator, getting to Sacramento is very difficult. There are a lot of customer needs that are not being met today with the service that we have at the airport. That possibly, and I know it changes, sounds like daily, but that the expansion and the renovations might allow us to have more a variety of services that aren't provided to us today so that we'd have more employments. But then when you consider the available grants and working around merging airlines and with the airlines and where do people really want to go, where are the business centers going to be by the time these projects are finished, I was really impressed. And with your patience, it's like a moving board game going all the time and you're trying to hit it just right. As a taxpayer, I just appreciate it, and I
think that the people that are here today might appreciate hearing that. Listening to you and talking to you, I know you have all of our best interests at heart there, and I just wanted to share that. I was
Thank
really
you.
Impressed.
Appreciate it.
Okay. Further comments from colleagues? Supervisor Hill?
You have a question, and I'll reserve comments until after public speaks. Thank you.
A lot to do with how you use the space, when is the space going to be used, and what capacities? Is it generating revenue? Is it not? But that was, based essentially on looking at what we were anticipating in the concept, and we thought the $15 million of money we would be eligible for, and we believe we would get it.
Okay, and let me a couple more questions, if I could. And you actually inspired a question in your answer there, which was how, in your experience, how closely do we see the FAA funding for things such as non-hub terminals and other kinds of improvements and enhancements in line with the actual airline industry's priorities, changes, and economics? I mean, because I know that's a big question, because to some degree we have FAA funding that's really provided by Congress, and that may be entirely independent of the private airline industry. But are you seeing FAA providing grants for things that clearly are not in line with the direction of the airline industry? And I'm not necessarily saying on this one specifically, but do we feel confident that funding is matching with the trends in the industry itself? If that makes sense.
And I'm probably going to punt over to my colleagues in the audience for a minute, but I would probably say for my part and my experience, the FAA does have measures in place where the short answer is not necessarily in terms of what the private sector is doing. The FAA does have measures in place where, a community that wanted to do something would do a benefit-cost analysis, and they would present that to FAA, and if it made sense, then FAA would participate. We asked that question here, and we're told that, given that we were a non-hub, we didn't need to do the BCA, and based on our employment levels in the past, the capacity we had. And, of course, one of the things I didn't bring up, because we brought it up last year when we discussed it, but the existing facility is actually, its location violates FAA standards, so they are really looking for us to make a move in some way, shape, or form anyway. But I think, gentlemen, do you have a – because you guys travel around more than I do.
Good morning. My name is Bill Hogan, RSNH. To further answer your question, Mr. Hill, the FAA, and I agree with Mr. Howell, the FAA bases their termination on their own formulas. In a non-hub facility, I believe it's a $20 million max for what you're eligible for a terminal facility. 75% of that being $15 million is a conservative number. We've been operating around 87%. It's up to your governing county board, the input from Mr. Howell. We like to think that we can provide information as consultants on that the decisions being made for the terminal building are based on the current facilities in noncompliance with FAA rules is one. And two is that I think that changing the facility will help with your other needs regarding what the private industry of airlines are doing. To gain some more employments. I think that allowing for a more efficient facility to attract people to come and use that, including the airlines, it would help you in the long run.
Well, let me add, if I could follow up on a comment you made then. If, in fact, we have seen other non-hub airlines, or excuse me, non-hub airports make some of these improvements using some of this FAA funding to do so. I do understand our need, and some of it has to do with the certain violations that we're in. Are we seeing that those improvements, that these new projects are leading to further service? Because that's really that's
yes to no, and to cap that, it's also that you don't lose anymore.
Right.
Is also part of that formula. We could provide you with some statistics at a future date for the last five terminals, non-hub terminal buildings we've done.
Right.
To show that. I think that the answer is more yes than no, but it doesn't lose you anymore. And today there seems to be some things that are happening out there.
Right.
Mergers, the government insists that they're still a good thing.
Mm-hmm. I think that remains to be seen. But I think that, as Richard mentioned earlier, you have the people that want to travel, and if they have a nice facility to go to and it's easier to get in and out of, and then I think the airlines will see that, and you can attract some more service.
Okay, thank you. I do think, and I have one more question for Mr. Howe, if I could, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. Obviously, I spent a lot of time on the airport because it's in my district, but I do think, you know, as was suggested, if we come to a discussion, and this may follow up on what Mr. Meacham was getting at, and we want to try to give some direction for a future plan of looking how much money is being spent and what we're getting for it, I think it would be useful to have some more information to see how the improve to have to spend money that it just for operations. How are we? You know, are those projections of PFCs overly optimistic?
To answer the last question first, no, we don't believe so. Looking at the schedule of events, if you will, if we were to move forward from this point, if you approve our action today and then we complete this project, we anticipate completing this project by summer. If you were to elect to go to construction documents, we would anticipate having that completed in the summer of 14. We've met with the FAA, discussed the availability of funding and their ability to fund the project. They've been supportive as they were in the past for the previous project. They run five-year funding cycles, probably, and I think from our part, and Mr. Isker might be able to help me with this one, we believe that probably the cycle we'd be looking at would be a calendar year spring of 15, that they would be able to participate with terminal construction. That would be the point. Actually, when we get to the, you know, the end of construction documents in 2014, that would really be the time when the rubber would hit the road for us, where we'd need to sit in this room and make a tough decision on what was going on at the airport at that time, whether we wanted to continue. We have the money to get ourselves through documents, so, you know, we can come back to the board and say, you know what, we're pretty certain this is what we're going to, well, we know this is what we're going to build. We're pretty certain this is what it's going to cost. We have if we need $7 million, we have $3.6 million in PFCs. We're going to have those, and we're going to need $3.4 million in some other funding source, a bond, a loan that the airport's going to have to do debt service on.
Right.
And then the question becomes, can the airport do debt service? But we're not committed to the project at this point in time where we have to say, okay, we're going to do that. Actually, the way we've structured the thing all the way down the line, the board has the ability, okay, we'll just put the brakes on this thing. We're not going to be able to do this right now. But we've got some time. You know, we don't know really. I mean, we've got a concept and we've got a number, but we don't really know what that number is going to be.
The most obvious being if we get to that point where we have to look at half of the local share being some sort of general fund loan.
Of some sort or a bond, you know. And, you know, we still have the availability. We could go, that may be a PFC revenue bond. You know, we could go back and ask the FAA to collect more PFCs. There's the potentiality for that also. We haven't got that real hard, fast number. Is okay, how much do we really need, and what do we need to do to get it?
Thank you, Mr. Howell. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hill. Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Certainly, this board has a fundamental responsibility of financial oversight, especially as the airport operates on as an enterprise fund. I have a more immediate question. If we go with your recommendation to proceed to Phase 2, what's that going to cost, and who's going to pay for it?
Dennis, do you have that cost for Phase 2 available? The money is going to come out of the FAA grant that we presently have and the PFCs we've presently collected.
Okay.
I can't answer you that. I'm not sure. Do we have an estimate what Phase 2 is going to cost?
Phase 2 of the current under contract design?
Yes.
It's about $250,000.
And that gets us not to construction drawings, though?
No, it does not. That's actually, you know, we're Phase 1 now. Phase 2 is schematic. And then there's actually a third and final phase of this project, which is final design development.
So just
when we come back to you with that one, that's when we'll ask if we can do documents.
Okay. And while I have the floor, do we have an idea of what it takes to get from Phase 2 to Phase 3 in terms of money?
To get into construction documents?
Yeah.
Not a hard number by any means, no.
I'll get that to you, sir.
Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Supervisor Arnold, followed by Supervisor Meacham.
My question was answered. It was just we do have the grant funding in hand to go on with what we're asked to do today, vote for Phase 2.
That's correct. When we came last year and the board approved the project, the funding was in place for all three phases of the project.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Howell,
Does the FAA take into consideration the financials of when they make this $15 million concession? I mean, if they look at our emplanements and we are down considerably, do they take this into consideration for that full amount, or will they reduce that somewhat?
I think, as Mr. Hogan pointed out, non-hubs are eligible for up to $20 million of FAA between entitlement money and discretionary money. It's up to $20 million for non-hubs. They did not require us to do a BC in this particular case, and I'm thinking the biggest reason for that is, yes, we do. You know, it is going to cost some money, but they're looking at two. Actually, ours falls into two categories: capacity, which is the ability to handle the passengers in the aircraft, but then safety. The current facility violates FAA safety standards, and they want us to do something about it. So I guess to answer your question, no, I don't see that that number going down. I would actually see that number going up because across a number of business units in FAA, they want to see us do this project. They're really anxious in us doing this project to create more capacity in the system and to create a safer environment.
I can understand their desire to do that, but they're not going to pay for all of this in the long run.
Oh, and others who have been working on this have done a nice job of laying out a staged approach. What I'm very comfortable with is that, as Richard noted, there's the ability to move forward as fast as we would like, as slow as we like, or put it on hold depending upon economic conditions. And it makes a lot of sense, given the uncertainty with the economy and the airline industry, that we can move forward and then subsequently put things on hold if we need to. I just wanted to add a little bit about the financial mix. As all of you are aware, but maybe for the benefit of the public, the airport is an enterprise fund, which means that it's intended to operate like a business, and that the revenues generated from its business are intended to cover its costs, and it does not receive a general taxpayer subsidy from the general fund or from other sources, for that matter. You know, one of the challenges with operating the airport is obviously been balancing the budget, and why it's more of a challenge. There's only so much we can do on the expenditure side. Obviously, the airport is highly regulated. We have to meet certain safety requirements, and quite frankly, you know, I think we're probably have gone about as far as we can go on the expenditure side. Not to say we can't, you know, nip and tuck here and there. Certainly, we'll be having that discussion here as part of 13-14. But the reality is, we can't drastically reduce expenditures and expect the airport to operate in a safe manner. So that really leaves us with the option of growing revenues, which has been a challenge. There was a big effort here recently to try to obtain service for Denton with a flight to Denver. We partnered with the Economic Vitality Corporation, with our Visitors and Conference Bureau, and really got the community involved to push as hard as we could. And it, you know, Richard may be able to provide more detail, but basically it didn't pencil out for the airlines. That it wasn't profitable, and they weren't going to come here no matter what we offered. And that's unfortunate. And I think we're struggling with that. So, you know, the challenge is, and then, so what do we do about the imbalance? You know, essentially try to keep growing revenues, look at the parking, look at other leases that we have. But there's a balance point there of being competitive in the marketplace versus just raising those rates. We've seen some pushback when we've tried to raise those rates in the past, so we're very sensitive to that, obviously. You know, there's always the option of general fund infusion or of loans, but, you know, we need to be careful with that. That's a very slippery slope if we start subsidizing our enterprise funds with general taxpayer dollars because they're not covering their costs. So what I wanted to add is a bit of perspective. There was a question of the $3.5 million that would need to be found somewhere to help build this should we get to the point where we want to move forward. You know, obviously, there are different options for that. One would be to float some debt in order to cover that. You know, just some real ballpark figures. It would depend on the exact amount and interest rates. But if we're looking at a 20 to 30-year loan on $3.5 million, we're probably looking at a debt service of a couple $100,000, maybe $200,000 or so. So coupled with a $250,000 current operating imbalance, we'd be looking at about a $500,000 imbalance, which is fairly sizable given the size of the operating budget for the airport. So those are the challenges. As I noted early on when I started this, is that I do think airport staff have done a really nice job of laying out stages and steps. This next step, should your board decide to go there, will present us with more information to come back, and there is relatively little local cost for this next phase. It's primarily funded by the feds. And then, you know, the real gut check time will be whenever we get to the phase of deciding whether we go out to construct this new facility or not.
Thank you, Mr. Buckshy. I'll open it to public comment. At this time, I've got two requests to speak. The first one is Mike Manchek, followed by Stacy Jacobs.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. Mike Manchek, the Economic Vitality Corporation. First, let me make a couple comments unrelated to the airport. One, I want to welcome on behalf of the Economic Vitality Board of Directors Paul Teixeira to the EVC board, who will serve also with Adam Hill, which is wonderful. And also I want to do a shout-out to Jason Giffen, who planning and directing builder, he's leaving, and it was very unfortunate. He's been a tremendous partner. I know he's in the audience here somewhere, I think. But he's been very instrumental in helping us achieve our objectives in the economic strategy. And I think he's actually set up a model for other counties to look at and follow. So thanks to him for that. Let me focus on the airport, if I could. One, the EVC has spent a lot of time and resources working with airport management to try to get more service and to advocate for infrastructure where it's needed. We have looked at and gone on many trips to visit the airlines. What I'm not hearing in the presentation is something, as I describe, as somewhat of a slippery slope. And that is this, is the businesses in this economy that we now have, which is warming up, they're needing the airport more and more flights than they had in the past. And the unfortunate thing is that we are in somewhat of a catch-22, because from the consultants, we're hearing that the communities that are ponying up or paying for some incentive that already serves the airport could bring Denver service, but it's closer to $1 million, not $400,000. And unfortunately, that's just what the market bears. But we also have to look at what I think our economy. We have this economic engine called the airport, and we have all these cylinders, as I describe, which are these clusters, right? And if parts of the engine are just not working, those clusters cannot work efficiently, and that's really unfortunate. We have just a couple of the thoughts here. In terms of a study, we helped commission a study that showed that over 53% of the traveling passengers in this county do not use our airport. And they don't for two reasons. The flights are too infrequent, and it's too expensive. So if we don't do something proactively to engage those airlines, to incentivize service, we will, in fact, probably have fewer people flying. And ultimately, the business traveler represents about 70% of the airline's revenue. And so that's why they're always interested in hearing what the EVC or its members have to say. That's why we go on those trips and use our resources to do so, because they want to hear what the business traveler is doing. The vacation traveler and the students that live in this county, they often will shop and shop until the fare is very low. The business traveler has to go when they need to. And that's why we were pleased to see SkyWest drop the walk-up fares to one-half of their amount, which is very helpful to the businesses that have to go when they need to. But I also, and let me just end with this. I heard earlier in the presentation about the county and its costs indirectly that are going up because of an economy. So in other words, you have the Department of Social Services whose cost for foster care is going up. Why? Because of a lack of jobs. This is that slippery slope I talk about, that if we don't do something and get more service and look at that as an incentive, but more so an investment in our future, we keep those jobs here. Otherwise, those companies leave, or they open up offices elsewhere, and they move those high-value people to other places where there's more service. I can't say enough about the job that Richard, Jeanette Pell, and the team has been doing out there. It's been great to work with them. But I know, and I'll end with this, that we're facing something for which we have to be competitive in the national market. Other communities are providing revenue incentives, and they're getting the service, and we're not. And I think it's not just going to fix itself, unfortunately. It's not going to get better unless we're proactive. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Mr. Manchek. Stacy Jacobs, our next request to speak.
Great. Good morning, and thank you. I represent Visit San Luis Obispo County, the Visitors and Conference Bureau, working in tandem with Richard and Jeanette and the team. I wanted to echo a little bit of the campaign that we really put forth amongst the business community. Obviously, as the Visitors and Conference Bureau, we see a great opportunity to have increased flight service coming into the San Luis Obispo County Airport because we believe that it will bring more leisure travelers. However, we also know to go get that new service that we really have to focus on the business traveler. With the study that Mike did that really proved that the demand for Denver was there. We actually took that to another level about a year ago right now where we gathered data from the business community to really understand what price are they willing to pay. And through that data that we gathered, working with the consultants at the Airport Engages, we were also able to really look at where the leakage is happening for our travelers. And it's not Monterey and Santa Barbara. If our travelers from here are going to get in their car, they're actually going to drive to San Jose or down south because they have more service options to be able to get out from there. And so we were trying to use all of that as our case to really share with United Airlines and SkyWest of why we needed that service going to Denver. We even went with 50 letters that really said, we would be willing to pay more. Give us an average price of $450 and we will pay more for the convenience of having a service right here. The one piece that we're missing ultimately with all of that is those incentives. So the airlines are asking us, what else can you do to incentivize us? What's our insurance policy for bringing additional service to your area? And I think as you look at the infrastructure, obviously the safety is very, very important of the airport. And as we look at those pieces, we also need to look at what can we do to continue incentivizing these airlines to bring more service here. I can't tell you how excited I am as I sit on the EVC board and see all these new business elements that are being created here in the technology sector and all these companies that are spurring up and having to build their own infrastructure because there's facilities that don't, that can't even, their employees are growing out of, essentially. And so how do we make sure that we have a service like the airport that can support our business and intuitively also support tourism, which is one of our largest economic drivers for this county? So with that, I just ask that you take that into consideration as you're making your decisions.
Thank you, Ms. Jacobs. I have no further requests to speak, so I'll bring it back to the board for discussion. Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do appreciate, I'll echo the sentiments of the work that is being done by airport staff and also with partnership with the business community. I've been involved with this from we have an element of speculation to them. We don't know, and there is no way that we could know that all of the investments we make in improving and enhancing the airport is going to then therefore lead to the service and the revenues that will help to have it flush. So what I'm comfortable moving forward, but I would like to see a plan as we move forward that looks at a few things that I think that we've brought up. One is I would like to see what are our options in the future if we're looking at 5 or so years, and we've made investments, but we have not been able to attract the increased air service that we had hoped for or that we need to really pay off this investments. What are our options? If one of our options is to subsidize from the general fund, which we don't like to do for an enterprise center, what would that mean? How would we do that? What would be the measurements? I mean, there have to be some options. I don't want, I guess the last option would be, we have a general aviation airport, which I don't think would make anybody particularly happy. But we do need to look at that because we don't want to be here or future boards to be here hearing the same arguments made, which is the airport's critical. We have to keep doing this. We have to do whatever we can, but not getting anywhere. So I do think we need to look at some of the information, some of the examples in specific data of people who have made these investments in improving their airport terminals and doing all the runway improvements that we've made, all of the enhancements, and whether that has led to A, increased service, B, the retention of service. Those are important benchmarks that we, as a board, having to make these financial decisions, I think really need to have. And I'll leave it to airport staff and admin to come up with, and I'll certainly leave it to my colleagues to add to that, too. But I would like to see a plan that does start to, start to give us some sense of where we're headed rather than things aren't great. but we need the airport, and we need to keep improving the airport, or else we're going to, you know, it's going to get worse. At some point, we need, you know, this board or a future board will have to make some tough decisions, and that tough decision may very well be just to continue to increase the investment in the airport through general fund subsidies. I don't know. That's something that I think we need more information on. But where we're at now and where we've been in the past in terms of being able to go about these, you know, these phases in ways that have allowed us to change course, the best example would be the parking, which when I came in was a parking structure, which we have now is a improved parking lot, which I think is much more sensible besides being more financially responsible. So we do have leeway to make changes and not to lose money, but I do think it's important that we have that accompanied with a long-term plan that looks at these things and has some really good benchmarks in it. But I'm comfortable moving forward for what we're asked for today with the understanding that we do need that plan. And I don't know what else could be in terms of the options that are presented to us in the future. They may be entrepreneurial incentive options that we have not yet considered. I'm not sure about that. That's certainly not my area of expertise, but I do want to be able to discuss those. So that's what I have to say, and at the time, I'll be happy to make a motion. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Supervisor Hill. Supervisor Arnold?
Yes. So then, Mr. Hill, I was just kind of doodling out the practical thinking. First, sometimes when Mr. Buckshy said, well, we have to make up our $250,000, and then if we had the debt service, it would be another. So we're talking $450,000 additional revenue. It sounded like a lot of money. But the $13 per employment plus this is a wild guess, but I'm saying somebody that's spending, going off on an airplane is going to probably spend $12 on the parking. So it just kind of generally speaking, say each employment's bringing in $25,000, and just extrapolating that out at needing to, I don't know how many, when you fill a plane, I don't even know that, but say $75 people a plane. It'd be less than one flight a day, far less than one flight a day, to bring in that kind of revenue. So if we were offering one additional flight a day and being able to pretty much fill it up, not even a day, 200 of the days of the year, we had one additional flight, there would come our revenue. So, thinking about it that way, it doesn't even seem like such a high risk. We're being able to attract customers and airlines with the enhancements, and all we would have to do is provide one more flight every other day, we'd have it. So I feel better about thinking that
person to come. I mean, if they would say, if we said, yeah, we have $1 million here, and they would come, what does that get us? And I think those kind of cost-benefit things are necessary so that we can say, well, that does make sense. And I'd be willing to put that kind of money out if I saw that return on investment. But I would support this because I think we need to get to the next step so we can start having the hard conversation about where are the dollars, what is it going to take.
Thank you, Supervisor Meacham. My comments basically reflect what colleagues have stated, but I also, having come from the private sector into this job, seen a vast growth in service and people coming to this area to serve the industry that we have. I can remember a number of years ago in my previous employment, we would be at the counter working and you'd see people drive by and we would call them salesman alerts because you'd see a guy drive by in a Chevy Lumina or a Ford Taurus with a suit coat hanging in the back, or they'd go down the end of the street and turn around and come and park in front of your building. They would come, they would find out what a great area it is, and the only time you would see them is when they were going from Los Angeles area to San Francisco or vice versa. Well, as they came more and more and they visited our area, they would bring their wife and their family, and we would have an abundance of these people on Friday or Monday because it was such a great place to stay. So we're darned if we do and we're darned if we don't. We've got a great area to live. People are finding this area to come and live here and bring their business, as Mr. Manchek said. So now it's like we know where we've been, we kind of figured out where we are, but where do we want to be in the future? Do we want to increase the size of the airport, which I would say yes, and go to that next step to bring these people to provide the service, to provide the economic engine that we need to have the county progress. So that was my comment. We'll go to Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm ready to make a motion to support, and I think staff understands some of the direction that we gave on putting together a longer-term plan that has some benchmarks and has some more information and also has some potential options, so that as we move forward, we're really looking at this with our eyes wide open. And I think it's important to understand that this is what we're doing. We're continually doing, even as the airport is struggling, which is safe to say, considering that we do have operational deficits, that we are making an investment that is critical to the entire community, not just the business community, but I think the entire community, which benefits. And from that perspective, I'm comfortable moving forward. And I think people do appreciate that investment that this board and this county continues to make in its airport. And so I move that we approve staff recommendation.
Second. Voice vote? Roll call.
Roll call.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson? Mr. Meacham?
Yes.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
And Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Howell. Yes, we'll take a 10-minute break and be back here at 11:10. Okay, we're back from break, and we'll go to the next item. Madam Clerk, if you would be so kind as to introduce the next item.
Item number 9, a request to approve a resolution authorizing submittal of the Urban County of San Luis Obispo Program Year 2013 Action Plan, all districts.
Good. Thank you. Mr. Lilly, good morning. Good morning, staff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Dana Lilly with your planning staff. I just wanted to make a couple introductory comments before the staff, Tony Navarro and Suzanne Adai, make the presentation. First of all, I want to encourage anybody in the public as well as the board to look at the Exhibit A that's revised in the core agenda, because there were some errors in the previous one. That's the table that lists the funding sources and the allocations by jurisdiction. So generally that's the exhibit that attracts the most attention. The second point is, at this point, we still do not know how much HUD grants the county will receive. As you all know, sequestration is taking place, but it is still not an easy task to try to calculate what our formula grants would be. Nonetheless, HUD requires us to submit our action plan by the middle of May, so we are using planning estimates, you could call them, as HUD has recommended. And then we will bring this all back to your board in the summer, probably late summer, to coincide the numbers of the action plan with our actual entitlements. Also want to make a point that HUD is continuing to stress with county staff that it's important for the county to do what it can program, and the emergency solutions grant may cost the general fund approximately $96,000 to $100,000 in staff costs. We still think it's a reasonably good investment, because even with the shortfall in another grant program called the Continuum of Care, $14 is brought in through these programs for every dollar of general funds spent in staff costs. And with that, I'll turn it over to the staff to make their presentation.
Good morning, Chairman Teixeira and members of the board, Suzanne Adai, Planning and Building. And so I'm going to go over the funding recommendations. Before I delve into the funding recommendations, I'd like to emphasize that today's hearing is the final public hearing for the preparation of the 2013 Action Plan. So now to our funding recommendations. As Dana pointed out, in light of recent federal budget cuts, we are assuming an 8% cut to our CDBG program, and another 10% cut to our home program, and we're not anticipating any changes to the ESG program. So our estimated funding for CDBG would be around $1.6 million, and for home would be $750,000, and for ESG would be about $163,000. For the Community Development Block Grant, known as CDBG, these funds are divided among five cities and the county based on population, poverty, and overcrowded housing. And you can see the allocations for each of the cities and the county. The national objectives of a Community Development Block Grant is to benefit low and moderate income people, prevent or eliminate slums and blight, and meet emergency community needs. So we can use CDBG funds for public services. As you can see, we have a number of nonprofits that are being recommended to receive CDBG funds, and this is basically the public services cap is 15%, and as you can see, we have seven nonprofits, and last year we had 17 organizations receiving CDBG funds, and this is down to seven nonprofits, and this is in line with HUD's direction, as Dana Lilly pointed out. So we have another category under CDBG. It's called economic development, and we're recommending $15,000 to Mission Community Services Corp for a Women Business Center program. And then under soft costs for planning and capacity building, we are recommending three projects to be funded with CDBG. One is homeless management information systems by the County of San Luis, and the other two are implementation of housing programs and housing element by the City of SLO and City of Paso Robles, City of San Luis Obispo. With CDBG, we can also use it towards public facilities project. A majority or an aggregate of CDBG funds are going towards architectural barrier removal. That includes handicap accessibilities. Another project is homeless campus project and facade improvements for the City of San Luis Obispo and City of Arroyo Grande. And then a large portion, this is county's share, it's going to the Oceano drainage improvements in Oceano. We can also use CDBG funds for housing purposes, and City of San Luis is recommending about $164,000 for the Rome project in the city for site acquisition. And we're also recommending about $11,000 to the North County Women's Shelter for the installation of the new HVAC system. Then we have the investment partnership program. For investment, for home program, we have the uses, eligible uses for home program is home buyer assistance, rental housing, tenant-based rental assistance, and owner-occupied rehabilitation. Staff is recommending home funds to go to tenant-based rental assistance and also to go to two and El Camino homeless organization and Capsule receiving more ESG funds. Emergency solution grant funds are also used for homeless prevention, and there are two organizations that are going to receive or being recommended for funding. They are Central Coast Link and Women's Shelter Program of San Luis Obispo County, and for projects under rental assistance and housing relocation and stabilization services. Then another category is rapid rehousing. Again, Central Coast Link and Women's Shelter Program of San Luis Obispo County are going to receive ESG funding. And we have the data collection, or HMIS, and again, we have three nonprofits receiving ESG funds. Now going to administration costs. These three project or programs, CDBG and home and ESG programs, they provide funding for grant administration purposes. And as you can see on this slide, we have administration funds for CDBG. That's about $200,000. And for home administration is $75,000. And as you can see, for ESG is $12,000. So with that, staff recommends that you hold a public hearing to approve projects under CDBG home and ESG programs and adopt the attached resolution approving the program year 2013 action plan and authorizing the Urban County to submit the 2013 action plan to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. This concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions from colleagues. Supervisor Hill.
Thank you. And this could be open to, thank you, Ms. Adai, to any of our staff on this. When it comes to CDBG, obviously the cities choose where they want to put their eligible funding. The county has decided, for instance, our biggest share, and maybe you can explain as to if there's something that points us to doing this, by far is, at least on the CDBG fund, is the Oceano drainage improvements. What goes into thinking? I mean, that obviously I understand that as I'm supportive of the project itself. We've had this before us with Public Works and quite a lot, and it's an important project. But we're looking also at it competing to some degree with, and maybe you can explain what I'm missing here, competing with things that are essentially social issues that have caused that continue to cause problems in the community, whether it be homelessness, lack of affordable housing, those sorts of things. Why are we spending, and I know we are spending ESG and the other funds on those other programs, but why are we spending this goodly portion on infrastructure improvements, even to a lowered income community? I mean, is there something that HUD is pointing us to say, do that, or how are we determining that? Why wouldn't that be coming from another source within the county?
Yes, Mr. Hill. So with the CDBG funds, we can use 15% of the total CDBG allocation towards public services.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I'm hearing is that you're asking why are we allocating a large portion of CDBG funds for public facilities rather than on public services. So we are meeting our cap, which is 15%. So we're meeting the requirement of the CDBG program. Then with the Oceano project, I'll defer it to my colleague, Tony, and he has more information about that project that he can tell you about that.
Yes, good morning, Chairman Teixeira, members of the board. I'm Tony Navarro, Planning and Building. The recommendation for the Oceano drainage project came basically, you know, the direction from HUD to reduce the number of projects that we allocate funding to. But also that project was funded with 2011 CDBG funds in the amount of about $190,000. So there was a shortfall in Public Works budget, and they needed about $417,000, and that's approximately what we had. And so that's why we came up with that recommendation, to fully fund that request, because it's an ongoing project and it meets other criteria that we have.
Were there any requests from some of our partners in the community in regards to homelessness or affordable housing that might qualify with? I guess I look at us spending money on a project, on something that we need to spend money on, but we're taking it perhaps from funds that are critical, especially now as things continue to be contracted at the federal level. You know, I know a lot of our agencies are scrambling just to be able to pay for their facilities.
Timeliness. So we're not sure how soon CAPSLO could spend the funds to build the homeless service center. We would probably lose funds taken away from us by HUD if we allocated it for that and it wasn't started right away, whereas the Oceano project is poised to start within another year and a half, I think, and we think that will go quickly.
So if take for instance Echo were to say that were to apply because they're trying to acquire a permanent facility, what would make them as competitive, I guess, within the staff's recommendations as improving the infrastructure, the drainage situation in Oceano? I mean, I understand that this is something that's ongoing, that we are able to put the monies toward, whereas something else may be something that is putting the money towards facilities. But, you know, I do understand, and I'll wait to hear from some of the members of the of our partners, that there are needs that may qualify within the same funding categories. But what are we basing our competitiveness on? Is it just what's ready to be applied, as opposed to what's more? And what I'm getting at is we have other ways to pay for our infrastructure that we have to. I don't know that we, you know, outside of the funds that we have here and some of our CBO budget that go towards helping some of the nonprofits in our community that are dealing with, in all parts of our community from north to south, some rather, crisis proportion problems with social issues.
I think I can take a stab at that.
Okay, thank you.
If Echo was poised and ready to purchase a property that would come online and operate and directly benefit the low-income community as required, and their other funding was arranged so that they could have convinced the staff that this is really ready to go, then it would have been highly competitive.
Okay. So we aren't... I don't mean to dig too deep publicly, but so we are looking beyond just our projects. I mean, we are spending most of the money from the CDBG, and I understand, as Mr. Daya explained, and that's always been a little bit of a frustration, that we're only allowed to put 15% towards public services where there is a great need. But our project is by far taking the most money. It's a worthy project. It's a needed project, no doubt about that. I just want to make certain that the criteria we're applying on competitiveness and all the things that meet HUD, and I know it's intricate, and I know you folks spend a lot of time having to navigate this, but I just want to make sure that we're looking at the true needs in the community and how that may, in fact, even impact everything else we do from law enforcement on down. So that we're not just funding for the sake of meeting the federal guidelines as best as we can, rather than meeting true community needs more effectively, if that makes sense.
No, you're absolutely right. There are other rating criteria that we publish in our annual request for applications, and we look at them all. I will have to admit that the timeliness requirement by HUD has become more important than it used to be. HUD is forcing us in that direction, but we definitely look at other criteria, and we wouldn't be averse to recommending funding for a homeless service center in Atascadero.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Supervisor Hill. Supervisor Arnold?
Yes, and that was I thank Supervisor Hill for bringing all this up. I wanted to discuss revisiting ECHO. I understand that there needs to be more information. ECHO needs to submit before you can really put it into the plan. But I would like to say that I'll work with you or work with them or bring it all together, that ECHO needs to be addressed in their project, their ongoing project right now, that it's my understanding it's close to ready, and for whatever reason I'm looking, all I can see in all this is under $20,000, and that is the major homeless service for the entire North County at this point. So I think we need to maybe revisit that if we could. And my other question and wish would be to revisit, and I don't see him on here at all, but North County Connection and their desire to start providing transitional housing for substance abusers. That's a well-established service center there in the North County that I can't imagine why we wouldn't be using some of this money to help them too. So those are my two asks. Thank you. Oh, one more thing quick, Chairman.
Go ahead.
Do we have to disclose what boards we sit on when we're doing this?
Which county council?
Supervisor Arnold, I'm assuming you may sit on some of the boards that are at issue today.
Several of these boards. All of a sudden, I thought, uh-oh.
No.
Dana, maybe you can help me out here a little bit.
Can we take a break?
No, I won't be as lengthy as Mr. Gibson, so I'll leave.
Amen.
Isn't there part of the criteria, one in which it requires to have a project done? You can't carry over funds and carry over funds for a project, can you? I mean,
yes, you can, as long as you don't violate the CDBG timeliness rule, which says the county, and that's the county and all the cities that are the CDBG grantee, should not have unspent any more than 1.5 times its entitlement at the beginning of April. End of April. Thank you, Tony. So that's actually going to be questionable whether we're going to meet that this year. It's going to be very close.
And then I guess as a follow-up, if you don't meet that, does that CDGB funding go away or can it be reprogrammed?
That's what we're dying to know. The worst case is that the excess amount over that 1.5 times that is unspent, HUD may say, okay, we're going to subtract that from your next year entitlement. That's the worst case, we think. The best case is they tell us you're on probation and you need to submit a workout plan to show how you're going to catch up by next year or the year after. We've done that before.
And so I would assume that this is all part of your thinking when you make recommendations to get something done.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Further questions, Mr. Gibson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In conversations with staff, I do appreciate the issue of timeliness and our ability to move these funds out. But going back to Supervisor Hill's questions and comments, not to pick on the Oceano Drainage Project, but I think the question he was asking is, what is the social impact of that project? How does it comport with the goals of CDBG, and how is it that it rose to the top of the list for the county projects? And I think those are important questions. I know staff does a lot of public outreach. There's a lot of detail in our staff reports, and we can read through that. I'm here, as I always am when we consider this particular item, to advocate on behalf of Los Osos, which has been in the queue for a very long time, where the social impact is very clear. There's a very clear individual burden, financial burden, that's going to be placed on low-income individuals in that community, which is not a wealthy one by and large, for connecting with a sewer project. And so I think the issues that Mr. Hill raises are extremely important, and I would like to put out to staff, and again, conversations offline have indicated that maybe we're not yet quite there on teeing up that, especially for Los Osos, especially if we have timeliness issues already. But should we end up with more CDBG funding than we think, I'd very much like to have staff think about Los Osos, because we are within striking distance of those funds being distributed. And that is a very clear and immediate social need in that community. So with that, I thank you, sir.
Great. Supervisor Arnold?
The only other thing I wanted to ask, and back in the old days when I was here before, there were so many, I was just thinking about all the other organizations that used to just depend on this money. And I understand what Dana's saying, that all the little, but 17, we whittled it down to 7 from last year, right? And that just sound, anyway, so what comes to mind right now is the Boys and Girls Club was one that used to come in and need money from this to continue and those kinds of things. In other words, politically, can we talk to the HUD folks? Or, it just seems like there were long-time organizations and, well, doing good work in our community. What happened to them? Did we tell them? Did we have to tell them no more of this and you can't have any more of this money?
A lot of them come in with the CBO funding.
Yeah, and there's two things I think that staff mentions, one of which is that HUD has directed us to administer less grants. And that's something that we've had to follow, and I'll wait to be corrected. The other thing is that, unfortunately, as we see the requirement on some of this, on CDBG in particular, 15% is the mess you can do on public services. So a lot of these organizations are incredibly worthwhile in terms of what they do for our community, but they're service-oriented, and therefore Mr. Meacham's right, where we do try to perhaps compensate for the constraints of some of this federal funding, we try to make up for it when we get to the fund center, 109? 106. I almost got there. I thought after my fifth year I would get the right number.
You're close.
106. All right. So, but it doesn't mean we can't have a discussion of exactly what's allocated once we hear from some of our public partners.
Good. Mr. Buckshy.
Yeah, if I could. I just wanted to comment on two things. And then I did just want to back up briefly to a point Dana made early on in the presentation about approximately $100,000 of general fund being used to help administer these programs. And in addition to this program at the Continuum of Care, which is a separate set of funding from the federal government for homeless programs, we're subsidizing to the tune of another $100,000. So about $200,000 county general fund is being spent to help run these programs. That was never really by design. It's been an incremental increase over the years. At one point in time, the administrative funds allocated for these programs covered the costs. And what's happened since that time is two things. One is the amount of money for administrative costs has decreased, and two, the amount of work that needs to be done, the requirements to comply with these federal grants, has increased. So essentially, we need to do more work for less money. And so something that we're working on planning staff and others are talking with the cities and some of our partners about how these administrative funds are allocated to make a more conscious decision moving forward as opposed to this incremental approach that's really occurred over the past 20 years. So we'll probably be having more discussion on that in future years.
Okay, further comments from colleagues? The only thing that I will add is the fact that Representative Oceano in the South County, they have the unique ability to need a great deal of funding because of the income level of the majority of the people that live there, and it allows them to qualify for a lot more things than other areas. I know with my predecessor, we used to argue about the fact of Oceano or Napomo, you know, and he'd say, no, Oceano, they've got all the criterion for the low income and everything to qualify for these programs. In Napomo, you've got Monarch, Dunes, and Jocko, so you don't qualify. So
Jocko's rolls them out.
Jocko's one of those big economic engines in the South County. Supervisor Arnold.
My last, it's just a question on the process and the timeline for adjusting this. How do we all just work with you after the...
Part of the time delay, and I'm going to say delay, is for a number of these recommendations, we'll need to go back through the Homeless Services Oversight Council to get that body's recommendations on anything related to the homeless. So we expect we could be back before your board in late summer. The program year doesn't start until July 1st anyway. We normally don't receive a grant agreement, and the funds don't start flowing till September. So we have plenty of time in that window to find out how much money is available, confirm some technical aspects of the projects, and then hold another hearing and bring the whole package back to your board.
Thank you.
Okay.
Can I have a follow-up question?
Yes, sir, Mr. Meacham.
Follow-up question to that, Dana, in regard to when the funds start rolling in. But if projects are approved, let's say the drainage project is approved, they can get started.
As long as we do federal environmental review first, the county can authorize projects to start. And as an example, if you don't mind me spending a little more time, in Shandon many years ago, the county was able to allocate some CDBG funds for water storage tank and transmission lines, but we couldn't allocate enough in 1 year because it was over $1 million for the project. So the county fronted the second year's costs, got the project done in 1 year, then paid itself back with CDBG the second year. And that works fine as long as we've done federal environmental review.
Thank you.
Okay. Never mind.
Okay, further comments? Then we'll open it to the public for public comment. I've got about four or five requests to speak. The first one is Jerry Rio, followed by Bill Waterfield. What? Okay. Excuse me. And Pearl Munich. Good morning, Mr. Rio.
Good morning. It is still morning. I'm here. I'm Jerry Rayouf, the director of the Housing Trust Fund. I'm here to encourage you to approve the plan and the allocation of funds. While I also would have liked to have seen more money given to housing projects, I have spoken with staff and believe that their recommendation serves the best needs of the county overall. When you look at the potential loss of funding, the competitiveness within the categories, and other funds being available in the future for projects that applied this year. The biggest problem is that these two funding three funding sources overall have had big cuts over the last few years. HOME and CDBG have been cut drastically. The most important thing I want to say is that I encourage you to approve the plan now. Any delay in approving the plan could jeopardize two important housing projects. The reason.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rio, if we are to commit to those particular projects, couldn't we provide commitment letters even if we are to readjust? Say if it's to this board's discretion to want to make some adjustments on some of the other allocations, but not in terms of the funds that would be towards those, couldn't the commitment letters still go forward?
My understanding is that you would have to adopt the plan in order to provide the commitment letters. Once you write the commitments, they would have to be binding commitments, so those awards could not be changed unless the applicants did something. But the balance of the allocations could be modified at a later date. You will always have that ability. You also have some unexpended funds to allocate later this year. And I hope that the staff was conservative in estimating the funding for this year. Hopefully, there'll be a little more. But who knows?
Thank you,
Mr. Rio. Thank you, Supervisor Hill. Further questions for Mr. Rio? Thank you, Jerry. Bill Watt, followed by Pearl Munich and Susan Warren.
Good morning, Chairman Teixeira and board members. My name is Bill Watt. I'm the executive director of El Camino Homeless Organization, ECHO. I just want to thank you for your past support, not just with the CDBG and ESG funds, but otherwise as well. I've been on the job 8 months now. It's been exciting. I wanted to thank the planning staff. They've been really helpful to get me up to speed during that 8 months. Morgan's been tremendously patient with me. Tony's been really helpful, and Dana have been helpful. And so I want to talk to you a little bit about where we're at with ECHO. We've had a very fast-moving time since this grant was not turned in. I submitted the Emergency Solutions Grant and the CDBG grants to the city of Atascadero and the city of Paso Robles. I did not submit it to the county. That was an oversight on my part. I'm totally responsible for that. I did submit it late when I found out that I hadn't turned it in. What's going on right now with ECHO has been moving very fast. December 14th, we started negotiations with the seller. We reached agreement on December 29th. We're currently two-thirds of the way through a 90-day escrow. We have our financing in place right now. We're hoping to close at the end of March. In the meantime, we are working with the city of Atascadero, building and planning. We're going before the planning commission on the 19th to get approval. And so right now, I just want to let you know that's where we're at. Our goal is to the day of close escrow, we have some immediate renovation that we need to do. We're going to be shifting from a church use to a shelter use. which is a fairly radical shift. The city's working with that, with us on that. But what we're basically excited about is instead of trying to run a shelter in a church, I mean literally where you have people sleeping in church classrooms, we're going to completely be able to move everybody downstairs into private rooms and a sanctuary. We won't have anybody upstairs. We're going to go all compliant with ADA, fire extinguishers, quite a few things. But it's going to be really exciting because about right now, 50% of our day-to-day problems, to be honest with you, have to do with trying to run a shelter out of a church. And not only that, running a shelter out of a church that was an active church. They were still operating there. But at the same time, they were tremendous. They were tremendously supportive of us. We are currently looking at the purchase of the property being done 100% with private funds, not using any government funds for that. What we're looking for is the renovation piece to be covered with a mix of private and public funds. At the same time, we're looking at continuing to have our services, case management, supportive services, be covered by a mix of public and private funds. What we're shooting for is to maximize everything.
Got it. Thank you, Mr. Watt. Appreciate it.
Yep. Thank you.
Pearl Munich, followed by Susan Warren and Grace McIntosh.
Good noon. My name is. It's easier for another agency to provide the casework than for us to do it because we are an all volunteer agency. We have no paid employees. We would have to go out and hire a payroll service and get a workers' compensation policy. And this is only a part time position. Also, it's cost effective to have a medical respite program, which is what we are, because we are able to keep people who have serious medical conditions from having complications, which are caused simply by the lack of adequate shelter, which would otherwise not happen. So they don't have to be hospitalized, and they don't have to keep going back to the CHC. They can get well, or if their condition is such that they can never get well, they can get into housing, but they can avoid the complications they would otherwise suffer. We are one of seven medical respite programs in the state of California, and most jurisdictions don't have it. So the nearest one is in Bakersfield, and we're the only one in this county. So it's I think, a cost-effective way of providing services. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Munich. Susan Warren, followed by Grace McIntosh and Robert Lane. That's my last request to speak.
Good afternoon, Board. I'm Susan Warren with representing North County Connection. And we're not in the 2013 action plan because we didn't apply, because we still have money on the books for CDBG, and it is there was $35,000 from 2009, and then from our 2012 allocations, there's a total of $133.614 that you voted on to allocate to us, along with Tascadero City Council for $55,000 of that. We, after 2.5 years, we have gone ahead and purchased the property. And we couldn't wait any longer. We were going to lose it. And after being there for 14 years without a complaint from a neighbor or anybody else, we had to move fast, and we needed to do it. And this had just gotten too unwieldy. Our concerns around that have been that there were a lot of barriers put up, and we just feel that we need to look at readdressing how we do with special populations, and I want to thank Supervisor Hill for and Supervisor Arnold for bringing this up. Why are we funding drainage projects and different things when we have such a crisis in our county? We have no very low-income housing. We have almost no transitional housing, sober living. We don't have anything. You know, what good is it do to try to get somebody clean and sober and leave them in the streets or couch surfing with their friends that are still using? So it only makes sense that we need to have a different plan of attack, because what we're doing isn't working. And I applaud you for looking at the human services, and it's going to save money across the board from your ERs, sheriff's department, everybody. And we can work together as a group, because we're taking care of the unwilling. You know, you've got shelters for the people that can follow those rules. We have our own rules, but we're taking care of a whole nother population. It's not competitive. And so anyway, this is where we're at. One of the things that my board has requested over and over from the department is, if they think we don't qualify as a substance abuse provider, we want a determination letter from HUD. And they have done that before, and they went to HUD and got a determination letter for a project with a women's shelter. And that's what we're asking. They keep telling us, well, we don't qualify because of this or that. We would like to have this allocation of money for us be stay with us so that we can do the renovations we can on the building. We're going to have a very low-income housing manager's unit within 6 months. And we can also, there's an opportunity there for us to even add some beds without adding new facilities. But we need people to work with us, because we're willing to work with the people. And that's where we're at, and we hope that you will see that we get this money that's already been allocated. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Warren. Grace McIntosh, followed by Robert Lane.
It is now good afternoon, Chairman Teixeira and members of the board. My name is Grace McIntosh. I am the Deputy Director of Community Action, who they are, if you didn't. Obviously, the Friends of Prado, the Interfaith Coalition. Cal Poly is wonderful. They're always out there working. And the People's Kitchen, who come and provide free meals for us at Prado. Without their support, we just couldn't operate. Volunteers are our lifeblood. And again, on their behalf, I want to thank you for your support and confidence. And then finally, I am thrilled to be able to work with Pearl as we go into this new phase. We have been working with Pearl and her group for many, many years, and we just applaud, and we just think what she and her folks are doing is amazing. And so if we can support her with the infrastructure support and with the staffing support, we would be fortunate to be able to do so. So that is all. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. McIntosh. Next speaker is Robert Lane, and the final request is Tyler Corey.
Good afternoon, Chairman and members of the board. My name is Robert Lang. I'm the Executive Director of Pacific Southwest. Our project is the Morro del Mar Senior Apartments in Morro Bay. And I'd like to thank the planning staff for the recommendation that they've made that's before you this afternoon, I guess. And to give you a little bit of background, this property has received a tremendous amount of support from the local community. The city of Morro Bay itself has invested in it. We've had support from Jerry Rio's organization. I've had funding from the Federal Home Loan Bank as well, and the Coast National Bank has also helped us through this time of preparing this project for construction. I would like to just point out that affordable housing financing is a very delicate construct. There are a lot of moving parts, a lot of different sources of funds that we have to bring to bear in order to be able to build something like this. And it's like a choreographed dance of money, if you like, as we apply for these funds from various organizations and at federal level, at the state level. We've secured long-term funding from the USDA under a program they have for a mortgage that is guaranteed, so we can get low interest rates, and on and on and on. And, of course, all these commitments have different start dates, different end dates when the commitment runs out. So my plea at this stage is to urge you to approve the plan as it's been set out today. I do realize that there are many, many worthy causes that do deserve funding from CDBG funds. Our funding is proposed to come from home funds, so it's a different pocket. But I think that this project is now on the verge of being able to be built, and I hope to break ground in October. The city of Morro Bay, I don't think, has seen any affordable housing for many, many years, and I think that they're very excited to have this done. And I think that if we can put the money to work and have something that we can show is delivered, I think that would be a tremendous benefit to the community, and it also proved to HUD that this can be done. That's all I have to say. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. Tyler Corey, that's our final request to speak.
Good afternoon, everybody. Tyler Corey, City of San Luis Obispo. I'm the Housing Programs Manager and work with county staff on administering the CDBG program. And I wanted to mention, as was previously discussed, how critical it is that you take action today for one particular project, which is the 313 South project. It is a project that staff's been working on for about 5 years. The city's committed over $2.2 million to this project. And the applicants are in a position where they have a strong application moving forward to the state for tax credits that needs to be submitted tomorrow. So without that, without board approval of the action plan moving forward today, that's not going to happen. The city has worked closely with the applicant as well as the property owner recently, because it's been in contract for so long, to extend it to allow this one last tax credit application opportunity. And so I just wanted to kind of remind the board and of that critical timeline that's before you today. Any delay would basically put this project in complete jeopardy with that. The city's committed over $500,000 in CDBG, $650,000 in Affordable Housing Fund money, and almost $1 million in impact fee waivers to the project. So significant contribution. I know the county's committed a lot of funding in the past for home funds and recommended to do so again today. So again, I urge you to adopt the plan today. Thank you.
Okay, that ends public comment. Comments from colleagues. Supervisor Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to just a couple of things. First of all, I'm going to abstain from the final vote so that there's no appearance of conflict in regards to CAPSLO's funding, but suffer. I just think that because these funds are so limited and our ability to help an organization like ECHO is limited to some degree, I'd love for staff to see work with ECHO on those renovation expenses that might be used and come back to us with those modifications. That would be mine. And also, I think the North County Connections termination letter is also an extremely important and useful thing to pursue. That could be part of coming back to us as well. And with that, I will shut up for the rest of now.
Supervisor Arnold.
I agree with Supervisor Hill. And the ECHO project is important for the North County, absolutely. And maybe we can hear from staff that if that's doable, to be able to approve this and still have the ability to provide funding. And secondly, the question that I have on North County Connection is, where is their money from prior years? How can we get that? Is this not a time to talk about that? Or
this would be fine if it's okay with the chair.
Please.
Yes, the staff had recommended, and your board and Atascadero set aside some CDBG funding in the past for North County Connection to purchase the facility where they're at now. It is a very important project.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
We consulted with our counterparts, our source of information from HUD, to inquire about the eligibility. What they told us was, that's a physical location where the clients come. Unless the clients fall into one of the categories that HUD regulations say that HUD presumes they're low income, then they have to ask for income information
to show over time that most of them are, in fact, low income. Without that, it's not eligible. Had the county and city spent CDBG funds and we could not prove that, HUD would take the money back. We've got guidance from HUD confirming that it's not a presumed eligible clientele. We don't have a physical letter. We can press our contacts with HUD to provide that. We would be happy to do that.
Okay. So we can help them off of passing this that's before us today. We can work on...
Yes, that's...
Providing. In other words, I don't want to vote and let this go by. And for those... I don't know if any of my colleagues have visited North County Connection, but it's been there for years, and they really do provide an amazing service, and I believe they're the only ones that provide that kind of sober living. And actually, it's been, Ms. Warren can correct me if I'm wrong, but it's been more of kind of a sober living counseling day kind of a service to date, and now they're trying to expand it to be actual living quarters for folks, but they've done a lot of good work in the North County. So it's hard for me. I just want some affirmation that if we pass this and go forward, that we won't be leaving them behind. As far as
staff will do its best to obtain a letter from HUD confirming whether that the clientele are or are not eligible. It's pretty much beyond our power to require HUD to do it.
We can ask them, though.
And it sounds like on all these projects, right? We pass it. That's what we did with North County Connection. We passed the county and the city, not we, but you all before I was here. The county and the cities allocated money for them, and they just haven't received that money yet.
Correct.
Correct? Okay.
Supervisor Meacham.
I just want to be clear on what we're doing here in terms of the process. If we pass this plan right now, Dana, you're telling us that you can readjust or readdress some of these other concerns that have been raised today and come back to us later?
That's correct.
Okay. I guess the one thing I would like to know, and I didn't read it in the staff report, I probably wouldn't see it in any of the applications, is the drainage plan, what exactly is that? I mean, is that an actual, are they actually going to do something or are they going to plan for something? Because if they're going to plan for something, I got a little bit of a problem with that. I don't want to see something done.
They've had a plan for some time, and they have engineering drawings now, and they have most of the funding put together to go ahead and put in improvements that will cure the flooding problem at 13th and Highway 1. Am I getting that right, Tony?
Yes, that's correct.
Thanks.
There's Jeff Lee.
And we've got Mr. Lee from Public Works to address that. Thank you, Jeff.
Good morning. Jeff Lee with Public Works. And yes, we definitely do have a plan. We have a preferred alternative, and it is going forward actually to the Planning Commission possibly as early as March 14th. And that'll continue the process towards approval from the Coastal Commission, the FAA, Caltrans, and other numerous funding sources that have participated in this. And so that looks forward to construction actually in fiscal year 14-15.
And Jeff, if I might, would this in here, but I'd like to know a little bit more detail in terms of if we don't do one thing, what does that mean to the effect of the overall concept of that project? And then if we add something to something else, what are we going to be adding to and what are we getting for that?
If I could just to answer it, because I was to the what I'm and I think Mr. Buckshy has an answer to that too, but I'm suggesting that obviously we do want to fund the Oceano Drainage Project, and I'm just saying whether we can take some of this money, staff working with ECHO to see how some of this funding from CDBG from this particular area can be applied to the renovations of their shelter. And there that would leave admin and Public Works to figure out how to pay for that, which I think we can. I think we can do both is what I'm saying. And the limited amount, as you've pointed out, the limited amount of funds that are available and have gone to this important North County shelter, I think this is an opportunity for us to do what Mr. Buckshy had said, is make the sort of value judgment.
Yeah. Okay, and I'm good with that, because I know that when we talked about funding some of the drainage issues down in the South County, we did talk about that from Public Works' standpoint, and there was some funding there to do so much. I would assume that there's, and I guess once again, we need to get back to figure out what exactly would we be reducing that project by and how could we backfill that through Public Works, and that's a discussion you folks are going to have. And then what is it that's necessary to do the improvements with ECHO? Those are things that I guess before I could...
Which way are you going to go?
Go from there.
Mr. Buckshire?
And it sounds like we're pretty clear, but just to make sure I'm clear. So if your board were to adopt as it is today and also make a motion that we revisit the $417,000 that's allocated for the Oceano project, you know, obviously some work needs to be done to identify exactly how much, which I think staff, we can certainly do that for what would be considered maybe a reasonable allocation to ECHO if that's the direction. You know, it's just 2 weeks ago that your board adopted the five-year facilities and infrastructure plan, of which clearly this project would be a component of that. And I think we can just go revisit that in the same time frame that we work on this. We'll look at where that fits in the priority. Maybe we need to shift a little funding from some other project or see if we can dig up some other funds. But I think we can absolutely bring some options back to your board.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Buckshire. Mr. Gibson, you have questions?
Mr. Meacham and Mr. Buckshire have covered it all.
Okay. Ms. Arnold?
I just want to be clear. So when is staff going to help craft a motion? And I don't know. We haven't heard any kind of monetary figure about what we're talking about helping ECHO with. So, if we threw out, everybody ready, $100,000 figure, is that something that...
I think that's premature, to be honest with you.
Is
staff
it?
Needs to come back with that recommendation.
Staff's going to try to figure out exactly what... If there is a reduction to this drainage project, we need to know what that would be. They need to know what that would be so that they can talk to Public Works to figure out how they could backfill that. In turn, talking to ECHO to find out exactly what they're going to need. I don't know. I mean, $100,000 may be more than they need. I mean, it may not be enough. I don't know. But I've been to the facility. I know exactly what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
And so I think it's premature to designate a dollar amount at this point in time. At this point, I would just move staff's recommendation so that we can move forward.
Second, with a slight modification, if I might, which is to direct staff to revisit the funding picture for the Oceano Drainage Project and the ECHO renovations, and also to work with North County Connection to get the necessary letter of determination that they requested.
That's what I was going to say.
That's why I'm here. I'm here for you.
We got the elder statesman at the outside, so you can meet with us. Okay. Further comments from colleagues? Okay.
Do we have that motion? And I'll second that motion.
It's moved and seconded. Okay, we need a roll call vote on this?
Yes. I do have a question, though, for council. The resolution that's being adopted approves the action plan, which also identifies the funding. So
I think what we're doing is approving the action plan, but direction is to come back later with the other. So I don't know whether that needs to be inclusive. I don't think it does.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure our bases are covered.
Just as long as we have direction to come back.
And we assume the motion is the plan as modified in the core agenda.
Right.
That's my motion.
Okay.
And you're sticking to it.
So, Mr. Meacham.
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Gibson.
Yes.
Mr. Hill.
Abstain.
Ms. Arnold.
Yes.
Mr. Teixeira.
Yes. Okay. If you'd be so kind to introduce the next item, and we'll continue.
So your next item is closed session.
Okay. I open it to public comment. See no public comment on closed session. Refer to Ms. Neal at approximate time.
Yes, Rita Neal, County Council, approximately 35 minutes today.
Thank you.
She's at a doctor's appointment. Ms. Craig, upon her retirement after 24 years with the County of San Luis Obispo, and item number 12, submittal of resolutions recognizing employees for 30 and 35 years of service.
Thank you, Ms. Douglas Schatz.
Let me move approval of presentation calendar, if I could.
We've got a resolution. We've got a correction first.
Thank you, Chairman Teixeira, members of the board. I just wanted to alert you that regarding item 12, we had to submit a new resolution to fix a typographical error regarding the commendation for service for the district attorney employee. So we've done that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Supervisor Hill.
Move approval of presentations.
Okay. Voice vote?
Roll call.
No, roll call. Thank you.
My second was
Mr. Meacham.
And you're adopting as amended?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mr. Hill?
Yes.
Mr. Meacham?
Yes, sir.
Mr. Gibson?
Yes.
Ms. Arnold?
Yes.
And Mr. Teixeira?
Yes. Thank you. Okay. Supervisor Hill, if you'd be so kind as to read the resolution honoring Ms. Craig.
Okay. Christine Craig, where are you? Would you like to come forward? There you are. Okay. Great. I'll read this, and then we'll let others say something about it. You get the last word, so that's the good thing. This resolution is commending Christine Craig upon her retirement after 24 years of service with the County of San Luis Obispo. Whereas Christine Craig is retiring from the county services after 24 years of dedicated and valued service, Chris began her career as a certified public accountant in 1976 in the San Fernando Valley, gaining experience from various public accounting firms, and then probably very happy to come up here. Chris began her employment at the county's General Hospital in May 1986 as an accountant 3, where she implemented software used for filing the annual Medicare and Medi-Cal cost reports. And in 1990, she was promoted to Hospital Administrator 2 to act as the controller for the hospital's fiscal oversight. Chris joined the Department of Planning and Building as an Administrative Services Officer Manager in March 2003 and became a respected member of the department's management team. And whereas Chris is a true friend, as well as a trusted supervisor, and always encouraged and supported those who worked for her to advance their skills, to be the best they could be, and to learn the skills that make them competent and competitive professionals. Now, therefore, be it resolved and ordered by the Board of Supervisors that Christine Craig is hereby commended for her 24 years of conscientious and dedicated service to the people of San Luis Obispo, and wished a happy retirement, enjoyable travels, and lots of time for fun. I think we can get a picture of Tammy. Will
okay.
Be so kind as it'll be backdrops like bad mountains.
Yeah. Dry. We're all dry.
Okay, 1, 2, 3.
We all can't fit in that little hole. Yeah.
Good afternoon, Chairman Teixeira, members of the board. I'm Jason Giffen, your Planning and Building Director, and it's my great pleasure to say a few things about Chris. I only had the privilege to work with her at the tail end of her tenure, but she's had 24 years of terrific service for the County of San Luis Obispo. Specifically for planning and building, she brought with her a sense of accountability. She notably was involved with focusing on transitioning from a valuation approach to our building fees to time and motion, essentially a more accurate time and motion and costing approach to building fees and the land use process. She also brought with her a sense of accountability and transparency for performance measures and metrics, which it's fair to say our department sometimes comes under scrutiny for. So we have Chris to thank for setting up the fundamentals and principles that we have in place that we continue to use today, whether it's part of our budget process or whether it's just reporting numbers of permits that have been issued to the public. From that standpoint, we're extremely appreciative of all the years of service Chris has given, and she always does it with a cheerful attitude and is always so pleasant to work with. So it's my pleasure to congratulate her on her retirement.
Thank you.
I wanted to jump in and say a few words, Cammie Griffin with the County Planning and Building Department. A couple of things. We actually brought Chris back. She's been retired for about a week and a half, and so we wanted to see how much younger she looked after being retired for a week and a half, much older we looked after her being retired for a week. I'm not sure which one. I've really appreciated Chris. When I was promoted to assistant director, I knew virtually nothing about budget, and Chris took me under her wing and taught me everything, and I so appreciate it because it was right when we were heading into the first year of the pain plan. So I really appreciate her.
Is at the county hospital or at planning and building or for any of the departments that I helped with on interim basis during that time period. Can't believe I didn't even come totally prepared today. Forgot about that. But anyway, I just really I highly recommend retirement a week and a half. And yes, I love it already. But thank you to everyone who's been a part of my life and a part of my career, and thanks again for everything.
Thank you, Ms. Craig, and good luck on your reinvestment in your, at the casino. Ms. Douglas Schatz, welcome.
Thank you very much. I am so pleased to be here along with Robin from the Human Resources Department to help your board honor those who have dedicated their careers to public service. And we have three service awards to give out today for 30 and 35 years of service, which is commendable. So without any further wait, when I call your name, if you would come up to the podium and get your award from Robin, and then you can get a handshake and a resolution from the board after they read it, and a picture, and then the department head can speak as well. So if we can give a round of applause to our first honoree, Wayne Hansen from Behavioral Health.
Okay, and I'll have Supervisor Arnold read that resolution.
Yep. Hi, Wayne. It's a pleasure for me to be able to read this resolution to you. And it reads as follows. Whereas Wayne Hansen has worked for the County of San Luis Obispo since November 28, 1977, without interruption, encompassing 35 years of employment. And whereas Wayne Hansen has worked throughout his career in drug and alcohol services, starting out as an alcohol services health educator, then became an alcohol services prevention program coordinator, that was July of 1985, then became a prevention and planning supervisor in September of 1989, then became a division manager in September of 1993, a healthcare analyst in December of 2000, and has served as an administrative services officer too since July of 2006. In the administrative division of the health agency, supporting the drug and alcohol services division. And whereas Wayne has successfully led coalitions that united many community interests in the cause of addiction prevention, including the creation of the Prevention Alliance focused on youth asset development and substance use education, which spawned many community task force groups, and the county's Tobacco Prevention Coalition, which has been instrumental in effecting policy which reduces the negative impact of smoking on the Central Coast. And whereas Wayne has over the many years provided leadership in the development of data collection and evaluation within the agency, reducing the reliance on and the cost for outside consultants, now therefore be it resolved and ordered by the Board of Supervisors that Wayne be and hereby is commended for his 35 years of dedication to the county mission, and it be it also resolved that Wayne is wished the best of health, happiness, and good fortune in his continued service and beyond.
Thank you. Good to see you, too.
Congratulations. Thank you. Can we get a picture, Wayne? Yep.
Oh, we got a bunch of
paparazzi. Yeah. Jeff's going to be in it, too.
Tall guy to be in it with him, so yeah.
In front of me, I think. You're
going to read it down, Jeff.
Having heard this resolution, I expected like a three-page.
You're blocking the view, Jeff. There's... Very good, thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the board, Jeff Hamm, Health Agency Director. Probably fair to say that all of us have some parts of our job that we like more than others. The parts of Wayne's job that he really likes, he's very passionate about. And he's passionate about health promotion and about prevention services, particularly in the area of substance abuse, from tobacco to methamphetamine, and you can tell from the issues or from the what we included in the resolution his commitment to those programs over the years. I was sitting right in front of him, and he did mention in response to Chris's comments about retirement oh, maybe I should retire. But I reminded him that he went into the drop program a couple years ago, so sort of got.
Chairman Teixeira, members of the board, colleagues, and friends, it's an incredible honor for me to receive this recognition today, and I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart. It was 5 years ago when I was here for my 30-year recognition. Jeff said, well, Wayne, I hope you're around for another 5 years. And I remember thinking to myself, well, we'll see. But here we are. Feels just like yesterday. But I do have a question about your service awards. You know, when you turn at 25, you award a clock. And at 30, a really nice wristwatch, which, by the way, I wear with pride. But what's the deal with this time metaphor thing? You're scaring me. Well, I definitely would be missing something if I didn't take this opportunity to pay homage and pay tribute to the men and women of County Behavioral Health, and particularly to those of Drug and Alcohol Services who devote their full time and energy to job number one, saving lives. That's what they do. They save lives. The suffering alcoholic and drug addict, the terrified individual with a mental health disorder, all receive an opportunity for a new life. It's not easy, but many rise to the challenge. Thousands, in fact, have risen to that challenge over the years and now lead productive and grateful lives. What an honor to be able to devote one's career to an organization that achieves such profound results. And what a privilege. Members of the board, what an opportunity to recognize and support that organization's achievements. Again, thank you very much for this award. I deeply, deeply appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, we'd like to honor David Pomeroy of the District Attorney's Office.
Thank you, Ms. Schatz, and I'll have Supervisor Meacham read that resolution.
It is truly a pleasure to do this, to honor someone that puts the bad guys away. This resolution commending David Pomeroy in recognition of his 30 years of service with San Luis Obispo County. Whereas David W. Pomeroy began working for the County of San Luis Obispo as a Deputy District Attorney on January 31, 1983, and has handled a wide variety of assignments for the District Attorney's Office, including misdemeanor trials, preliminary hearings, child dependency cases, narcotics prosecutions, adult and child sexual assault cases, general felony trials, and acting as felony trials team leader. And whereas David Pomeroy has successfully handled some of the District Attorney's Office's most serious cases, including the murder cases of People v. Fred Mazza, People v. Cassandra Scott, People v. James Bash, People v. Alan Ness, People v. Stephen Padilla, People v. Matthew Levine, People v. Andrew Downs, and People v. Robert Bradford, the first vehicular murder prosecution in our county. And whereas David Pomeroy in 2013 has been selected by the Pacific Southwest region of the Anti-Defamation League to receive the prestigious Helen and Joseph Sherwood Prize for combating hate for his successful efforts in the 2012 prosecution of the People versus Jason Kahn in the cross-burning case. Therefore, be it resolved and ordered by the Board of Supervisors that David W. Pomeroy be and hereby is commended for his 30 years of dedication to the county mission, and also be resolved that David Pomeroy is wished the best of health, happiness, and good fortune in his continued service and beyond.
Get a picture of Mr. Shea here.
Very well, sir.
She doesn't have the white lens on. Oh, it should be okay. I should be in the end. Okay. Right. Okay. We're going to time in, Mr. Shea. Okay. I know how lawyers are. We know how lawyers are.
Good afternoon, Jerry Shacey cases. But Dave truly truly excels in the courtroom. He's an excellent litigator. He's an unbelievable litigator. And that's why over the years he's been given some of the most important cases our office has had. Thinking of the resolution, which cited a number of those murder trials, but one of those cases actually cited in the resolution was the first vehicular murder case that our office had back in 1994, the Robert Bradford case. And Dave's work on that case was really a pioneer work that led our case in our office into the future in terms of the vehicular murder cases that we've had thereon. In 2008, he led the prosecution of a man named Matthew Levine. You may remember that case. He was convicted of the murder of his 84-year-old grandmother, who had taken him in, I think, in her home in Cayucas. The many other murder cases that Dave has handled, and you heard a lot of them. Thank you very much, Supervisor Meacham, for reading that resolution. He's done a great job on those cases, but he's handled some other non-murder cases, some non-homicide cases that have been really, really important for our county. Remember a few years ago we had a rash of bank robbery cases. Dave handled a number of those cases, including the Kincaid and Simmons case, which was a bank robbery out of the Citibank in Paso Robles. And then soon after that, the knife attack on a homeless man at Mission Plaza by a repeat offender by the name of Harley Finney, which Dave tried a couple of years ago. I think that was Dave. And last year, as was mentioned in the resolution, Dave effectively handled and tried the People versus Kahn four-defendant cross-burning case, which occurred in Arroyo Grande 2 years ago this month. For his efforts in that case, Dave, along with three others from the county, will be receiving the prestigious Helene and Joseph Sherwood Award for Combating Hate in California to be presented by the Southern California Anti-Defamation League next week at a luncheon down in Los Angeles. And the reason that I wanted to chronicle all of those things for you, because I think it's important for everyone to hear what Dave's done in his career, but it's kind of the reason why I said at the outset that Dave has been so valuable to our office. And that is, as you can see, from his earliest efforts to his most recent efforts, he has been a consistent, dedicated, and really, really effective trial attorney throughout all 30 of those years, from the beginning to the middle, and even most recently. And he's not done yet, right, Dave? Continue on, I hope. And I just wanted to add one more thing. It's important to note that despite the fact that every fall, like all University of California alumni, Dave gets really excited and optimistic about his Cal football team. They win the first three games typically of the season, and then they lose the next five, and he gets kind of down about that. But Dave has nevertheless been a really, really positive influence in our office. He's mentored some of the newer attorneys in our office. He's instructed law enforcement from throughout the county, and he's been a really great guy besides being a really great litigator and a really friend to everybody in the office. So, and that's why we're so lucky that this thoughtful former philosophy major from Cal Berkeley decided to join our county some 30 years ago this past January. Congratulations, Dave, and thanks a lot.
Thank you, Jerry, and thank you to the entire board. I really appreciate this. This is a high honor. The reason I've been here 30 years is we have a great office. We have probably one of the best prosecutor's offices in the state right here in San Luis Obispo. And I feel very fortunate, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity to have worked here and to continue working here. Thank you very much. I'm honored.
Thank you, Mr. Connolly.
And next, we'd like to honor Terry Prince of the Office of the Sheriff Coroner.
Mr. Gibson.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My pleasure to read this resolution honoring Terry Prince. Whereas Terry Prince has worked for the County of San Luis Obispo without interruption since February 1st, 1983, encompassing 30 years of employment. And whereas Terry, starting out as a clinical laboratory technician with the County General Hospital, was promoted to supervising clinical laboratory tech in 1985, transferred to the Sheriff's Office in 2006, reclassified to a Sheriff's Forensic Laboratory Specialist in 2012, where she currently works in the Crime Lab Detectives Unit. And whereas Terry is flexible, respectful, compassionate, and always goes the extra mile to improve the level of service provided by the Sheriff's Office Forensic Toxicology Laboratory, and whereas Terry Prince continues to demonstrate excellence and dedication in her current assignment, and her professional approach to her work is a benefit to the citizens of our county, now therefore be it resolved and ordered by the Board of Supervisors that Terry Prince is hereby commended for her 30 years of dedication to the county mission. Be it also resolved that Terry is wished the best of health, happiness, and good fortune in her continued service and beyond.
Want to get a photo here with the sheriff?
In reality, she remembers everything, as I come to find out. But when I was a new police officer, we took all of our arrestees up to General Hospital to get our blood tests. And so we'd always walk away with that blood sample in an envelope signed. And I remember Terry so well, so early, because we'd have to put it in our reports who drew it. It was always T. Prince, always. And so I go way back with Terry just from working in the field up at General. And we were fortunate when General eventually closed, Terry came over to the sheriff's office in the lab. Terry has a bachelor's degree from Cal Poly and a master's degree. Extremely intelligent, extremely easy to be around. She is the, and her colleagues, one of which is standing taking photos, are the true CSIs. Not the TV version, but the true CSIs. When you go in their lab, you really get the sense that not only do they take great pride in their work, but they take great pride in their facility and their fellow partners back there. I'm fortunate. Maybe they have shown this side to others, but they always seem to be of good spirits and smiling. I feel like I've gotten to know Terry a little bit, that I can tell when Terry wants to say something to me so bad, but she's afraid that she's just going to overwhelm me, so she backs off. There's that old saying that big things come in a little package. This is it right here. She's got it all. Most recently, I just want to highlight that Terry's been successful in two different grants, and really, when she sets out to do something, she seems to do it and do it in not only style, but her finished product is absolutely unbelievable. And I've been so impressed with what work she has done, particularly in the areas of grants, because I have, of course, read the grants, half of which I truly don't understand because of her terms. But the truth is, she's gotten the county two grants, both in 2010 and 2011. The first one was for $95,000, and the second one she's still currently working on is for $175,000. And that has not only purchased equipment, but it's given Terry in the lab the ability to take what we're doing for local agencies, probation, law enforcement agencies, to a whole new level. She has had three interns through Cal Poly, and that's not a job to them. That's their career that they want to follow. And Terry's mentored them and guided them along the way. And they all look, you know, when Terry's around, Terry speaks, you know, she's E.F. Hutton. They listen. They obviously very much follow her and very much care about Terry. So, Terry, on behalf of your colleagues in the audience and the sheriff's office, thank you for everything you've done for us. You still got plenty of years left in you, so don't get any thoughts. We need you. So, thank you.
So does that 3 minutes really mean I only have 3 minutes? Because I prepared a PowerPoint presentation.
As long as you're not longer than the attorneys,
guys,
you're okay.
I have to admit, I am known as the person they have to go like this to when I'm giving classes. I want to take this opportunity to thank everyone for the chances I've had as a forensic specialist. The opportunities to write grants as part of the sheriff's office is something that I didn't get to experience in medical services. So for that opportunity, I'm very grateful. And I will stipulate the rest of my testimony to the DA's office. Anyway, thank you very much, and hopefully I'll see you here at 35.
Very good.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your service. Thank you all for your service, and thank you for being here. Madam Clerk, would you introduce the next item, please?
Item number 13, a hearing to consider an appeal by Roy Ogden, attorney representing Darren Shetler, of the issuance of a grading permit, PMT 2012-00534, at 300 Green Gate Road, south of the city of San Luis Obispo, to allow grading for a horse arena in an existing pasture, District 3.
Thank you. Ms. Horton, are you be leading this off today?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, good afternoon, Chairman Teixeira and members of the board. This is an appeal that Bill Robeson from our office has been handling, and I will let him present the information to you.
Welcome, Mr. Robeson.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Teixeira, board members. I'm Bill Robeson from the County Planning Department. So this is an appeal of Green Gate Farms LLC grading permit. In other words, it's an appeal of the planning director's decision to issue and final. Again, the property is agriculturally zoned, so this whole green area is agriculture. And then you can see some other zoning categories to the north and south. The property here and public facilities is the land, the landfill, Coal Canyon Landfill. For some more context, here's an aerial photo. The property is outlined in white here. Green Gate Road, which is the private road that accesses the properties to the north. Highway 227 is going north to south. Again, Coal Canyon Landfill to the south, and the SLO San Luis Obispo Country Club is to the north. Here's a zoomed-in aerial photo. Again, Green Gate and Highway 227 to the west. This is where the actual specific site area for the horse arena is, outlined in white. Here's a little bit closer aerial photo. Horse arena once again. the main horse barn is here. It's pretty apparent. It's up on a hill. It's a white structure with green trim. And the main residence is here to the northeast. So a little bit of history on the project. Back in September of 2012, a grading permit for the horse arena was applied for. The basic description is 1,990 cubic yards of cut and 1,475 cubic yards of fill material, and there's about 1.9 acres of site disturbance. On October 3rd, the county issued a minor grading permit, so it went through our office. We issued the permit for the horse arena, and during that time, on October 12th, after the issuance of the permit was appealed. And during the process, after issuance, obviously there is a building inspection process that goes on. The site inspection was done along with the grading inspections, and the permit was finaled on November 5th of 2012. One thing to touch on as far as grading permits, appeals of a grading permit don't suspend the permit like in a land use type situation, land use permit type situation. The applicant is made aware that there are inherent risks of moving forward because the appeal may be upheld and the work may need to be remediated. In this case, the applicant was made aware of that risk and proceeded with the horse arena, the installation of the horse arena. So there are appeal issues that come along, and the appeal form first stated the first appeal issue as the project has not been adequately described. Staff reviewed the project. The application described succinctly that there was grading to level the ground for a horse arena. The approved plans are titled Grading and Erosion Control for Green Gate Farms Arena. So that was straightforward. Continued staff response. The site has historically been used as an equestrian facility, as I alluded to earlier in the presentation. The grading permit was issued for the grading for a horse arena consistent with the scope of work that was described in the application and the grading plans. And lastly, for this appeal issue, the county building inspector confirmed the field work, compared that with the plans out in the field, and ultimately finaled the permit. Appeal issue number two, the project has not had adequate environmental review. For minor grading permits such as this one, we do an analysis, and we determined that a Class 4 exemption under CEQA was adequate. Class 4 exemptions are described as minor alterations of land, water, and or vegetation with no tree removal. They do give examples in CEQA, and this is a kind of a summary of that. CEQA does talk about grading on land slopes less than 10%, and this is qualifying for a CE that is Class 4. The Class 4 CE does not allow for grading in waterways, wetlands, or scenic areas or officially mapped areas of severe geologic hazards. And Class 4 does not apply where the project may impact a designated or mapped environmental resource of concern. During our analysis, we apply our mapping layers. We did that, and there were no sensitive resource areas in the area.
A minute.
It should be sufficient. Roy Ogden, my address is 656 Santa Rosa Street. Greetings, Mr. Chairman and honorable board members. Welcome. I did ask Mr. Robeson to turn on the overhead because I do have a few things to share with you today. I will talk fast so I can use my 10 minutes wisely, but hopefully not too fast. So the reason I'm here is for you to consider this horse arena in the context of all of the other piecemeal projects that are going on and were going on by the same applicant at the same time, and the cumulative effect of all of these impacts. Now, prior to the applicant purchasing this property, the applicant had a pre-application meeting with the county, and I'm going to be entering all these documents into the record. At that pre-application meeting, the applicant made it clear that it would want to develop an event center at this address, also an equestrian facility at this address. And staff said, well, we need to know the size and scale. We need to know how much parking, because that won't be used for ag production. We need to know the minimum impacts of the to the greatest extent possible. We need to use the existing structures for ag uses as much as possible, because equestrian is not an ag use. Equestrian is an incidental use, so it needs to be subservient to ag operations. Had to have findings that ag on site or off site won't be impacted. Concerned about dust generation, a concern for both on and off site ag operations. So escrow closes, and then we learn that they want to do weddings. And so weddings began to show up on this applicant's website. Now, I was personally assured by the applicant's attorney, everything will be done with permits. Don't worry. We're going to follow the process. But around August 20th, it was observed that 60 to 80 truckloads of soil were brought onto the site. So I contacted the applicants and the land planner at the time, Carol Florence, and sent her an email. And that's also going to be in the record. And that email said, hey, Carol, there's a lot of dirt by this drainage channel that goes into this water feature on the property. It's a pond, and this is the headwaters to it. It looks like someone's going to put that dirt in the channel. Don't let it happen. Well, it happened. And so then the applicant had to talk to the authorities about why it did that. Now, at this point, my experience is county agencies usually step in and say, I'm going to be the lead agency. I'm going to do an initial study. Well, since that never happened, none of the other agencies could jump in and say, here are our concerns. On September 5th, I sent a detailed letter to Jason Giffen, and I pointed out 13 issues that we would like the county to consider when approving any permits for this property One of the issues was these fairly large existing stockpiles of horse manure. And I'm not suggesting that you can see them from space, but here's an aerial that shows some fairly significant manure stockpiles. We were concerned about that and the effect on groundwater. What are they going to do about that? What are they going to do about future stockpiles? We were also concerned about the history of flooding at the site. And so we sent them some pictures. Here's Green Gate and the 227. It's not showing up too well, but that's water you're looking at.
Please.
I'm sorry?
Can you give the microphone, please?
Oh. Thank you. Happy to. So, other pictures of historical flooding on the property. We're concerned about having this flooding along Green Gate Road addressed. You can't really, it's really not picking up the flooding, but all this is water. And so there were concerns that we put forth in our September 5th letter. I'll submit that September 5th letter as part of the record. So even though the applicant was talking to the authorities about filling in this drainage ditch, the applicant brought another 60 to 80 from the reports I got, truckloads of dirt, and hauled in another stockpile of soil. So on September 6th, I wrote a letter saying, hey, they're doing it again. Then we realized that there was a barn that's within the setback of Green Gate Road, maybe 6 feet from the road, that was just a deteriorated, dilapidated barn. They started rebuilding it. So we said, hey, there's no permit for that. Well, they were allowed to rebuild it. And we said, wait a minute, it's in the setback. If you're going to because the applicant wanted to put 120 horses on the property. Well, that may be fine, but there's usually a permit process that has to be followed in our county to do that because equestrian use is not an ag use. And so the evidence, I believe, that the county relied on to allow all of those concerns that were in the pre-application that I already read to you go by the wayside was, one, a letter from a lady who's probably a nice lady, Mrs. Stream, but she lives out of state and has for years, so she doesn't know what's going on the property. And two, horse boarding contracts signed by J Stream. The name was whited out, but it looked like J Stream's signature to me. I've seen it before, and I knew him. He was a good guy. But he died in 2006. And so the applicant was not, as far as I can see, demonstrating to the county that the equestrian use, to the extent of 120 animals, was ongoing 6 months before obtaining the property. And that's the rule here. It's got to be within 6 months. So that brings us to the issue that you heard about already, and now it's the horse arena. So we had sent the county a picture of the area where the horse arena is, showing that it's got water in it. Maybe it's a marsh. That's not the exact area where the arena is, but it's close, and we can't tell, because we don't have a picture of where the arena is, what was going on there. So there are a few things I want to point out that are incorrect, in the staff report, and that it says that grading is allowed here because it's not a wetland. We really don't know if it was a wetland or too close to the to an existing wetland or not, because it wasn't reviewed. It says that exceptions apply except where there's a designated environmental resource of critical concern under local agency regulations. And grasslands in the Edna Valley are known to support special status plants. Grassland habitat has a potential to support birds. This stuff just wasn't studied. But the most interesting thing is that county says, well, this horse arena is okay because it's an established equestrian facility. But the permit was issued before that finding was made. The finding was made eventually, but the permit was issued and then the finding was made. So it was not an established equestrian facility when that finding was made. And so I'm just asking, will somebody look at the totality of the circumstances out there? Now I understand that these developers are going to do an Avila-type barn in the main barn there right along 227. But, you know, I don't know what they're up to because they haven't applied for any permits. And they've done a lot of pre-development. I'm just concerned that if someone doesn't stop this pre-development, then we'll never know what the combined effects of all these cumulative impacts might be. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ogden. Any questions from colleagues at this point?
I'll wait until after the...
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, I'm just going to put my documents over here. For Mr.
Very good. Thank you. Good afternoon, Ms. Kirk. You're representing the applicants.
I am. Good afternoon, Chairman Teixeira and members of the board. My name is Jamie Kirk, and I'm here representing the ownership of Green Gate Farms. John Wilson and Brad Goodwin are both in the audience today, so they're present to answer any questions that you may have. I'm newer to the project, so I might not have a lot of the history, but I have been reviewing the file. I've been working with staff, and I did have a presentation prepared. And, Phil, don't worry about it. I think my presentation was basically... almost exactly is Bill's presentation. I think I'd like to spend my time responding to the items that were brought up by Mr. Ogden. There has been a lot of history on this property, some interest from one neighbor in particular, Mr. Shetler, and there's been a lot of attention put on to this property. Every time there is a truckload of dirt brought in or every time it looks like there might be some construction occurring on site, the county has been notified and other agencies have been notified. I should have brought a screenshot of the permits, the recent permits that have been in process in the Tidemark system. Many permits, and it's all for restoration of the existing buildings on the property. The grading permit is for the arena is the topic we're talking about today, the subject of the appeal. It's not all of these other issues that have been brought up by Mr. Ogden, but I think it's important for your board to know, and I think staff will attest, that they've been involved and they've looked at every issue. It's been an ongoing horse operation. We have documentation not only from Mrs. Stream, but a ranch manager that's been there for 30 years, that the operation was ongoing. When the current ownership purchased the property, there were 120 horses on the site. So I think I'm going after the notion that the use isn't an existing permitted use. I don't think that's going down the right path because it is. But they applied for the business licenses allowed in the ordinance to continue the use. Staff verified that, and I think most of you have been out there. I think most of you are familiar with the property. You know it's been, the use has been there. A couple other things that were brought up, just clarification for the record, the barn. There was the barn that's closer to the road, there was a permit to restore the barn. There are no offices or bathrooms in the barn. I was there. Haven't seen those. And the comment that we're going to be looking to do an Avila barn in this location, if we're looking to do an Avila barn in this location, you know what? We're going to be coming in for land use permits. So that will go through the proper process if and when that type of application is submitted. We are working on a land use application right now, looking at doing a conditional use permit for some limited events on the site. So that will be able to be thoroughly vetted through the public process. And with that, I'll conclude my comments. I'm available for questions, and ownership is here if you have questions for them.
Thank you, Ms. Kirk. Questions from colleagues?
Not at this time.
Nope. Okay. Any requests for public comment? Seeing none, we'll bring it back to the board.
Give them a chance for Mr. Ogden a chance for the rebut.
Yep. Mr. Ogden, your closing comments? We give him
right.
3 minutes.
I probably should have mentioned that the staff report also said that I did this for Darren Shetler. I did it for his family. I did it for my family. I'm not a hired gun. I'm here on my own accord. I'm not being paid for this. And I understand that, you know, you could look at all these little things separately, but It's just disconcerting when so much goes by the wayside, and we have this set of rules and regulations, and you know, maybe it's good that people can sidestep them, but you know, it's great news if Jamie's going to apply for a permit now. That would be great, but what's going on should stop. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Kirk, do you have rebuttal? Okay, thank you. Okay, bring it back to the board for discussion. County Council. Is it really you this time?
It's really me, Rita Neal, County Council. As the board deliberates and asks questions, you might want to take a little break before you make your final decision to make sure that staff, Mr. Robeson and Ms. McDonald, have an opportunity to review the documents that Mr. Ogden submitted. We believe most of them have been reviewed by the Planning Department prior to today, but we just want to make sure that we've had an opportunity to look at all the documents.
Great. So. If, thank you.
Yeah, I was going to ask that and maybe even ask that of Mr. Ogden. I have, just for the board and the public's information, I have met with both parties on several occasions, once with Mr. Ogden and Mr. Shetler and Ms. McDonald and Mr. Robeson have toured the area and Green Gate Farms with Mr. Wilson and Mr. Goodwin, and have spent time speaking with both Darren and with Ms. Kirk, too. So I guess a lot of these were issues that I know I've discussed with Mr. Ogden before, and is there something new that you have? I mean, we'll take a break anyway, Mr. Ogden, but I wondered if you wouldn't mind letting us know if there is anything new that you've submitted that staff has not seen previously.
Well, the only thing I can think of is that you mailed to Carol Florence asking her not to let her clients fill that drainage in. Other than that, everything should be in the county files.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Actually, let me correct that. I did have an excerpt of the sensitive species of animals and flora and fauna that would typically be found in the Edna Valley. It's not specific to this property, but I did put that in there. You have not seen that. I think that's item 16 or 17. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Questions,
quick.
Mr. Gibson?
If I might just ask a couple quick questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I see we have our Chief Code Enforcement Officer here, and I would ask of planning staff, are there any code enforcement cases open on the subject property, either as to unpermitted construction or unauthorized land use?
No, there's no open code enforcement cases.
Have there been complaints that have been investigated by code enforcement?
Yes.
Okay, so they've resolved those. And then I wonder if staff just might speak to the question of whether they have analyzed the potential of piecemeal development off of a pre-existing use and your conclusions on that.
We have to the contrary, so.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Thank you, Mr. Robeson. Mr. Meacham?
Just quickly, Bill, something I've never been able to understand is why equestrian isn't considered ag. If they were out there riding cattle, would it be considered ag?
If they're riding cattle, yes, it would be considered ag.
It's bovine equestrian.
But yes, that's just a use that is not considered agriculture. Horses aren't considered a production like beef, swine, sheep. So they're considered kind of a working type animal, not an agricultural animal.
Okay. Any further questions? Okay, then I'll take County Council's recommendation. We'll take a 10-minute break and reconvene at 2:43. Okay. Thank you, Madam Clerk. Okay, we're back. County Council.
Thank you, Rita Neal, County Council. Over the break, staff and council had an opportunity to review the documents that Mr. Ogden has submitted. It appears that planning staff has reviewed and seen all of those documents. They are now officially part of the record, and I think Mr. Robeson will confirm that it doesn't change any of the staff's recommendations today, but I'll let him speak to that.
Thank you. Bill Robeson, County Planning. Yeah, exactly. We both reviewed the packet that Mr. Ogden submitted. There's no new information in there. It's documents I've already seen or have in my file.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Robeson. Comments from colleagues? Mr. Hill?
Just wanted to know if Mr. Robeson or counsel wanted to respond to Mr. Ogden any further than in staff report.
Sure.
I mean, is there anything?
In general, Mr. Ogden was explaining that there has been several permits taken out I think he was talking about work being done without permits. All of that work has been covered by permits now. The barn that he alluded to was not rebuilt. It was a repair and maintenance project. It stayed in the same location. There was no expansion of the barn, and it's still a barn that's for ag use only. So there's no office space or residential space inside that barn. The other permits have all been clarified and have been issued. There are also a few more permits coming in. From my experience out on the property, it's really a property that's been used over the years, but it hasn't been maintained that well throughout the years. So that's kind of the phase that they're going through right now, is maintaining the landscaping, the tree trimming, and then upkeep of the buildings themselves. So that type of work does not require a land use permit, but can be done through individual permits.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, and I'll defer to my colleague. Oh, I'm sorry.
Just want to make a quick comment that I think that,
As
Mr. Robinson mentioned, a lot of the stuff has been repair work, and this has been neglected for a number of years. I think that the repair work that's been done is very commendable, and I don't know that I'd spend that kind of money on something like this, but these guys are obviously going to make something of quality out of what has been there and has been a really beautiful place in the past, but once again been neglected for so long that I think now will add to that particular area. As you heard Ms. Kirk mention, that if they are going to be looking for events and that sort of thing, they are going to be coming back for a public hearing, and I would hope that you folks get a chance to talk. So. That.
Thank you, Supervisor Hill.
Yeah, I think that's about right. Though I do think that Mr. Ogden and Mr. Shetler have legitimate concerns. Piecemeal development is always a difficult thing because to some extent you're speculating. And early on when I was spoke with both Mr. Shetler and Mr. Goodwin, I just told Mr. Goodwin to make sure that that they work with the county. And that everything that they do is as permitted, and I believe that to be the case. I do think I think we've come some distance. Hopefully, so we want to keep our Edna Valley peaceful. So, with the what comes next, I do think we would want to see that. It's up to them, but certainly it'll come before planning for a conditional use permit, and that will give. Mr. Shetler, Mr. Ogden, a chance to weigh in, or perhaps before that they can work with the owners and come to some amenable agreement, and we won't have to see any of it. But with that, I do think that I will move to uphold the decision of the planning director on this.
Second.
Okay. Madam Clerk,